John Michael Greer's The Wealth of Nature, Economics as If Survival Mattered, beginning on page 159. This is the last chapter and a half of the book. The entire supply chain that keeps the internet and its potential competitors running has to be factored into these calculations. It's easy to see the internet as uniquely efficient if all you take into account is the energy going into your home computer. The gigawatts used by server farms are not the only unnoticed energy that goes into the internet, though. Putting those gigawatts to work requires an electrical grid spanning most of a continent, backed up by the immense inputs of coal and natural gas that put electricity into the wires, and a network of supply chains that stretches from coal mines to power plants to the oil wells that provide diesel fuel for trains and excavation machines. The server farms draw on a vast array of supporting services and manufacturers, from the overseas mines that produce rare earths for semiconductor doping, through the factories that turn out components to the colleges that turn out trained technicians, and the list goes on. All told, a fair fraction of the world's industrial economy helps support the information age in one way or another. And many of those support functions can't be done at all in a less centralized way or at a lower level of technology. Most of the potential replacements for the internet don't suffer from that limitation. It's entirely possible to build a shortwave radio by hand, for example, using components that can be built from readily available materials. There are radio amateurs alive today who did precisely that before the pre-war electronics boom made manufactured components cheap and as easily accessible. And a shortwave radio can communicate across continental differences just as effectively as the internet does. As the cost of concentrated energy becomes a major economic burden, these differences will matter and give a massive economic advantage to less energy-intensive ways of accomplishing things. The economics of contraction. To suggest that the internet will turn out to be not the wave of the future, but a relatively short-lived phenomenon on the crest of the age of cheap, abundant energy, is to risk running headlong into the logic of abundance already discussed. It's essential not to get caught up in thinking of how many advantages the internet might provide to a post-abundance world, because the advantages conferred by the internet in no way mean that it must continue to exist. The fact that something provides an advantage does not guarantee that it is economically viable. An example from one of the most famous cases of social collapse is relevant here. On Easter Island, the native culture built a thriving society that got most of its food from deep water fishing, using dugout canoes made from the once plentiful trees on the island. As the population expanded, however, the demand for food expanded as well, requiring more canoes, along with many other things made of wood. Eventually, the result was a deforestation so extreme that all the tree species found on the island went extinct. Without wood for canoes, deep water food sources were out of reach, and Easter Island's society imploded in a terrible spiral of war, starvation, and cannibalism. It's easy to see that nothing would have offered as great an economic advantage to the people of Easter Island as a permanent source of trees for deep water fishing canoes. It's just as easy to see that once deforestation had gone far enough, nothing on earth could have provided them with that advantage. Well before the final crisis arrived, the people of Easter Island, even if they had grasped the nature of the trap that had closed around them, would have faced a terrible choice. Leave the last few big trees standing and starve today, or cut them down to make canoes and starve later on. All the less horrific options had already been foreclosed. Further back in Easter Island's history, when it might still have been possible to work out a scheme to manage timber production sustainably and produce a steady supply of trees for canoes, doing so would have required harsh trade-offs. One additional canoe per year, for example, might have required building or repairing one less house each year. Both the canoe and the house would have yielded significant economic advantages, but it wouldn't have been possible to get both. In a world of limited resources, in other words, it's not enough to insist that a given allocation of resources has economic advantages. You must also show that the same resource resources would not be better used in some other way or for some other need. This sort of thinking will inevitably be applied to technology in a future of energy and resource constraints, and any attempt to make sense of the future of that future in advance needs to start by embracing that sort of thinking now. One useful way to assess the vulnerability of any current technology, in the post-abundance world, in fact, is to note the difference between the direct and indirect energy inputs needed to keep it working and the inputs needed for other potentially competing technologies that can be provided, that can provide some form of the same goods or services. All other things being equal, a technology that depends on large inputs of energy will be more vulnerable and less economically viable in an age of energy scarcity than a technology that depends on smaller inputs. And the larger the disparity in energy use, the greater the economic difference. In turn, communities, businesses, and nations that choose less vulnerable and more economical options will prosper at the expense of those that do not, leading to a generalization of the more economical technology. It really is that simple. You might think that this sort of economic analysis would be an obvious and uncontroversial part of peak oil planning. Of course, it's nothing of the kind. Most discussion and planning around the subject of energy futures these days pays no more than lip service to economics, if it deals with that dimension at all, and a great many of the plans being circulated these days look very appealing until you do the math and discover that the most basic questions about resource inputs and economic outputs haven't been addressed. Part of this blindness to the economic dimension is hardwired into contemporary culture. It hardly needed the mass exodus into delusion that drove the recent real estate bubble to prove that most people in the industrial world nowadays think that getting something for nothing is a reasonable business plan. We have lived with so much abundance for so long that a great many of us seem to have lost any sense that there are limits we can't borrow or bluster our way around. To a very great extent, indeed, the last 300 years of economic expansion have been driven by a borrowing binge, even more colossal and ultimately more catastrophic than the one that began its implosion in 2008. The difference is that instead of borrowing from banks, we borrowed from the Earth's stockpile of fossil carbon and squandered most of our borrowings on vaster equivalents of the salad shooters and granite countertops that absorbed so much fictitious value during the late boom. By the time nature's collection agencies get through with us, they may have repossessed everything we bought with our borrowings, which is to say nearly everything we've built over the last three centuries. This wholesale contraction will pose an additional challenge on the future, because nearly all of our recent technologies displaced older technologies that provided the same services on a more sustainable basis. Here again, the internet provides a solid example. The collapse of the newspaper industry is one widely discussed example of the internet's toll on older and more sustainable information media. But another, the death spiral of American public libraries, is likely to have a much wider impact in the decades and centuries to come. Among the most troubling consequences of the current economic crisis are wholesale cuts in state and local government funding for libraries. Some of the proponents of these budget cuts have been caught in public insisting that with the rise of the internet, nobody actually needs public libraries anymore. Of course, public libraries provide many services the internet doesn't, and provides them to all people, all those people who can't afford internet access. The crucial point here, though, is that the public library will still be viable a viable information technology in a post-petroleum society. When Ben Franklin founded North America's first public library, after all, he did it without benefit of fossil fuels. If public libraries can be kept open during the waves of economic crisis that will punctuate the end of the age of abundance, everyone will likely be the better for it. I am sorry to say that this is probably not the way things will fall out. The current wave of library downsizing is very probably a harbinger of things to come. Pressed between too many demands and too little funding to go around, library systems, like public health departments and a great many other institutions that make community life viable, are far too likely to draw the short straw. Exactly this sort of short-term thinking drove the loss of vast amounts of information and cultural heritage in the collapse of past civilizations. As we move into the penumbra of the deindustrial age, then, it's crucial to start thinking about the options open to us, individually and collectively, with an eye toward their long-term viability and to the hard reality of a world of ecological limits. When today's data centers are crumbling ruins long since stripped of valuable salvage, and all the data once stored there has gone wherever magnetic patterns go when they die, the thinking that led politicians to gut library systems on the assumption that the internet will take up the slack will look remarkably stupid. Still, the habits of thought instilled by the age of cheap abundant energy are hard to shake off, and from within them, such mistakes are hard to avoid. The twilight of the machine. The end of the age of cheap abundant energy thus brings with it an unavoidable reshaping of our most basic ideas about economic development. For the last three centuries or so, as already discussed, the effective meaning of this phrase has centered on the replacement of human labor by machines powered by fossil fuel. All the other measures of development, and of course plenty of them have been offered down through the years, either reflect or presuppose that basic economic shift. The replacement of labor with mechanical energy has even come to play a potent role in the popular imagination. From the machine-assisted living of the Jetsons to the darker image of reality itself as a machine-created illusion in The Matrix, the future has come to be defined as a place where people do even less work with their own muscles and minds than they do today. All this is the product of the logic of abundance, the notion, rooted down at the core of industrial society's worldview, that there will always be enough resources to let people have whatever it is that they think they want. Abandon that comfortable but unjustifiable assumption, and the future takes on a very different shape. In a world where everything but human beings will be in short supply, it makes no sense whatsoever to deploy increasingly scarce resources to build, maintain, and power machines to do jobs that human labor can do equally well. An example may be useful here. Let's take Rosie the Riveter, the iconic woman factory worker of Second World War fame, and match her up against one of the computer-guided assembly line robots that have replaced so many workers and production lines in the industrial world. We might as well pit icon against icon and call the robot HAL 9000. Both of them serve the same economic function, we'll assume, riveting parts together on an assembly line. It's a credo of contemporary economics that HAL is more productive than Rosie. But since the term productivity in contemporary economic parlance means labor productivity, or in other words, how much production you can get per worker, any machine is by definition more productive than human labor. In a world of resource constraints, though, this definition of productivity becomes very hard to justify. It may be true that HAL can work long shifts at all hours with only the very occasional break for maintenance. At least this is what the robot salesman will tell you, and Rosie cannot. Still, in a world of resource scarcity, Rosie has a crucial advantage that more than offsets HAL's capacity for night shifts. Her operating requirements are much less energy and technology intensive to meet than HAL's. We can start with the energy source used by each riveter. HAL requires electricity, quite a bit of it, within fairly tight specifications of voltage, amperage, and cycles per second. For her part, Rosie requires food, and though she's been known to take a second helping at the factory cafeteria, her fuel needs are fairly modest compared with those of the machine. Her tolerances for variability in energy sources are also much broader than HAL's. If you have trouble believing this, spend a few minutes paging through an old wartime cookbook. HAL's maintenance requirements are just as exacting. He needs lubricants that meet precise specifications and an assortment of spare parts ranging from zinc bushings to integrated circuits, none of which he can provide for himself. All of them must be manufactured off-site, and some, such as integrated circuits, cannot be made without extremely expensive, complex facilities demanding intricate technological infrastructures of their own. Rosie's maintenance needs, by contrast, involve little more than 8 hours of sleep and a modest additional amount of food. I'll have two scoops of smuggling today, Franny. Thanks. It's been a hard shift. When it's necessary to replace HAL, a huge array of industrial facilities, mines, smelters, chemical plants, chip fabrication plants, and one or usually several factories have to be brought into play to produce HAL 9100. Unlike HAL, Rosie can manufacture her own replacement, and while it will take most of 2 decades before Rosie Jr. is ready to tie her hair up in the bandana and take her place on the assembly line, Rosie's own working life is still longer still, so the replacement cycle is not a problem for her. In a world with nearly 7 billion people on it, now more than that, of course, it's hardly necessary to wait for Rosie herself to reproduce in order to find a new riveter, or 10,000 of them. Finally, what happens if the economy changes so that there's no longer a need for so many riveters, as happened at the end of the Second World War? It might be possible to retool HAL for some other industrial purpose, but for reasons of efficiency, most assembly line robots are designed for a very limited range of operations and get mothballed or go into the scrap heap when the demand for their services goes away. Rosie, on the other hand, is capable of a nearly limitless range of productive economic activities and can head off to some other career when the factory closes down, leaving HAL to sing Daisy Bell to himself on the deserted assembly line. These arguments could be developed at even greater detail and with less whimsy, but I trust the point has been made. HAL's appearance of greater productivity depends on access to a support system of factories and services vastly larger than the one Rosie needs, and his support system in turn depends on the availability of cheap, abundant energy and a wide range of specialized resources and supplies that hers does not require. What makes HAL more economical in an age of resource and energy abundance is the low cost of that fossil fuel energy. During an age of resource scarcity, the equation changes completely, because the goods and services that support Rosie can be produced with much simpler technology and with much less in the way of concentrated energy than the goods and services that support HAL. There's a reason for this, of course. Human beings, along with all other living beings, evolved over millions of years in a world of energy and resource scarcity. Our hominid ancestors and all their ancestors down through the lineage of evolution, all the way to those first prokaryotic cells back in the dank Archean mists, spent most of their lives confronting the hard logic of Malthus, by which populations rise right up to the limits of carrying capacity. There are some multicellular organisms that have requirements as exacting and purposes as limited as most machines, but there are not many, and our species ranks right up there with rats, crows, and cockroaches among nature's supreme generalists. It's only in the highly atypical conditions of the last 3 centuries, then, that machines are more economical than human laborers. This is why, for example, nobody in the Roman world used Hero of Alexandria's Alleopile, the first known steam engine, as a source of power for industry or transport. Craft traditions in the Roman Empire would certainly have been up to the challenge, and the Alleopile was much discussed at the time as an interesting curiosity. What was lacking was the recognition that the black gooey stuff that seeped from the ground in certain places, or the black flammable stone that we call coal, could have been used in large quantities as fuel for such a machine. Lacking that, in turn, the Alleopile was never more than a curiosity, for the fuel supplies that the Roman world knew about were already committed to existing economic sectors, while human and animal muscle were abundant, familiar, and cheap. As the industrial world winds down, human muscle will again be abundant. Will it be cheap? Almost certainly yes, and that means that real wages for most people in the industrial world will continue their current slide toward third world levels. I wish I could say otherwise, not least because my chances of taking part in that slide are tolerably high. Still, part of what has made the last 3 centuries so atypical is the extent to which ordinary people in the industrial world have been able to rise out of the hand-to-mouth existence typical of most of humanity for most of history, and partake of a degree of comfort and security. That state of affairs could never have been permanent, because it was made possible only by using up fantastic amounts of fossil sunlight at a pace so extravagant that the quest to figure out what to do with all that energy has been a major driver of economic change for more than a century now. It's simply our bad luck to live at a time when the bill for all that extravagance is coming due. All this should be fairly straightforward and uncontroversial. It isn't, of course, because the contemporary faith in the superiority of the machine reaches deep into the irrational levels of our collective psyche. When Lewis Mumford titled one of his most significant works, The Myth of the Machine, he was not engaging in hyperbole. The thought that Rosie the Riveter could go head-to-head with HAL 9000 and win is unthinkable to most of us. It's a matter of folk belief throughout industrial society that the machine always wins, or at least that any victory over it is as temporary and fatal as John Henry Pyrrhic's triumph over the steam drill. The machine is our totem, the focus of a great deal of our culture's sense of value and purpose, and most people in the industrial world accord it the same omnipotence that older religions claimed for their gods. The sheer volume of popular culture over the last century or so that fixates on the notion of machines taking over the world and treating humanity the way industrial humanity has so often treated other living things is one indicator of the mythic power machines have come to hold in our collective imagination. It's for this reason, I think, that so many of us simply can't imagine a future in which machines will be less economically viable than human labor. Yet if it costs the equivalent of $5 a day to hire a file clerk and a secretary at post-abundance wage scales, and it costs the equivalent of $10 a day in expensive and unreliable electricity to run a computer to do the same things, those businesses that hope to succeed will hire the file clerk and the secretary, and the computer will be left to gather dust. Now it's true, as fans of computers are quick to point out, that computers will do things that secretaries and file clerks can't. But the reverse is also true. Try asking your computer sometime to go pick up takeout lunch for the office from a place that doesn't deliver. And many of the abilities unique to computers are contrivances rather than necessities. Businesses got along very well without them for thousands of years, remember. The technology that's useful to help a human worker do his job more effectively is not the same as the technology that's needed to replace him or her with a machine. As cheap, abundant energy becomes a thing of the past, replacing workers with machines will no longer be a viable option, but providing workers with tools that will make their labor more productive is quite another matter. The problem here is that very few people are used to thinking in these terms. While every industry in the world once had a vast amount of practical knowledge about the tools and training human workers needed to do their jobs well, nearly all of that knowledge is endangered, if it hasn't already been lost. Consider the slide rule as one example among many. Until the 1970s, it was the engineer's inseparable companion. Every technological advance from the mid-19th century until Apollo 11 landing on the moon was made possible in part by competent manipulation of this simple, flexible, ingenious analog computer by people who knew how to make the most of its strengths and work within its limits. Since it doesn't require a massive and technologically complex support structure to construct, maintain, and operate them, any good cabinet maker can make one, and their proper fuel is a scoop of the same slumgullion that kept Rosie going on her shift, slide rules are likely to be just as useful on the downslope of the industrial age as they were on the way up. If, that is, anybody on Earth still remembers how to use one when we get to that point along the curve of economic contraction. This is where the myth of the machine, the conviction, as irrational these days as it is pervasive, that the best person for any job is always not a person at all, but a machine, stops becoming a curious twist of our collective imagination and turns into a trap we ignore at our peril. As peak oil moves closer to center stage in the historical drama of our time and makes the gargantuan technostructure we've built on a foundation of cheap, abundant energy ever more problematic to sustain, the most common response from the centers of power and the masses alike is to call for the development of even more complex, gargantuan, and tightly interconnected machines, pushing the technostructure in the direction of greater risk and greater dysfunction. It's hardly an exaggeration to suggest that if it turned out we were all about to perish en masse from building too many machines, the first reaction of most people in today's industrial cultures would likely be to insist that the answer was to build more machines. Thus, we will doubtless see plenty of shiny new machines built in the years to come, and they will doubtless do their fair share and more to push industrial civilization further down the arc of its decline. As the ancient Greeks knew well, it's the essence of tragedy that the arche, that the particular excellence of a tragic hero, also turns out to be his harmatary, or fatal flaw. Put another way, a civilization that lives by the machine can expect to die by the machine as well. The heretical minority that has learned to mistrust the myth of the machine, however, may well keep in mind that as the age of scarcity dawns, educating people is a far more useful project than building machines, and doing as much as possible to ensure that individuals, families, and communities have the skill and simple tools they need to work productively may just be the most promising response to the future ahead of us. There's nothing really remarkable about that future. It's simply that the unparalleled abundance that our civilization bought by burning through 500 million years of stored sunlight in 3 short centuries has left most people in the industrial world clueless about the basic realities of human life in more ordinary times. It's this cluelessness that underlies so many enthusiastic discussions of a green future full of high technology and relative material abundance. Those discussions also rely on one of the dogmas of the modern religion of progress, that the accumulation of technical knowledge was what gave the industrial world its 3 centuries of unparalleled wealth. Since technical knowledge is still accumulating, the belief goes, we may expect more of the same in the future. Now, in fact, the primary driver that drove the rise of industrial civilization and made possible the lavish lifestyles of the recent past was the recklessness with which the Earth's fossil fuel reserves have been extracted and burnt over the last few centuries. The explosion of technical knowledge was a consequence of that, not a cause. In what we might as well get used to calling the real world, that is, the world as it is when human societies don't have such immense quantities of highly concentrated energy ready at hand, the primary constraints on the production of wealth are the natural limits imposed by the annual yield of energy resources and raw materials from the primary economy. Even after 2 billion years of evolution, photosynthesis only converts less than 1% of the solar energy falling on leaves into chemical energy that can be used for other purposes. And that only when other requirements, water, soil nutrients, and so on, are also on hand. Other than a little extra from wind, running water, sunlight, and other naturally occurring energy sources, that trickle of energy from photosynthesis is what a non-industrial society has to work with. That's what fuels the sum total of human and animal muscle that works the fields, digs the mines, wields the tools of every craft, and does everything else that produces wealth. This, in turn, is why most people before the industrial age had so little. The available energy and the other resources that can be extracted and used with that energy are too limited to provide any more. The same limits apply to today's non-industrial nations, though for different reasons. Here the problem is the assortment of colonial and neocolonial arrangements that drain most of the world's wealth into the coffers of a handful of industrial nations, and leave the rest to tussle over the little that's left. The 5% of the world's population that happens to live in the United States, for example, doesn't get to use roughly a third of the world's resources and industrial production because the rest of the world has no desire to use a fair share themselves. Rather, our prosperity is maintained at their expense, and until recently, when the current imperial system began coming apart at the seams, any non-industrial country that objected too loudly to that state of affairs could count on having its attitude adjusted by way of a coup d'etat or a color revolution stage managed by one or more of the powers of the industrial world, if not an old-fashioned invasion of the sort derided by Tom Lehrer's ballad, Send the Marines. Over the last century or so, a handful of insightful thinkers have tried to explore ways in which the cycle of exploitation and dependency can be broken. Schumacher is perhaps the most important of these. Even though he brought his substantial background as a working economist to bear on the problems facing the world's non-industrial nations, he drew his central ideas from a different source, the largely neglected economic ideas of Gandhi. Most people in the industrial world think of Mohandas K. Gandhi as a spiritual leader, which of course he was, and as a political figure, which he also was. It's not as often remembered that he spent quite a bit of time and effort developing an economic theory appropriate to the challenges facing a newly independent India. His suggestion, to condense some very subtle thinking into just a few words, was that a nation that had a vast labor force but very little money was wasting its time investing that money in state-of-the-art industrial plants. Instead, he suggested, the most effective approach was to equip that vast labor force with tools that would improve their productivity within the existing structure of resource supply, production, and distribution. Instead of replacing India's huge home-based spinning and weaving industry with factories, for example, and throwing millions of spinners and weavers out of work, he argued that the most effective use of India's limited resources was to help those spinners and weavers upgrade their skills, spinning wheels and looms, so that they could produce more cloth at a lower price, continue to support themselves by their labor, and in the process make India self-sufficient in textile production. This sort of thinking flies in the face of nearly every mainstream economic theory since Adam Smith. Since nearly every mainstream economic theory since Adam Smith played a role in landing the industrial world in its current mess, I'm not so sure this is a bad thing. Current economics dismisses Gandhi's ideas on the grounds of their inefficiency. But this has to be taken in context. Efficiency in today's economic jargon means nothing more than efficiency in producing somebody a profit. As a way of keeping millions of people gainfully employed, stabilizing the economy of a poor nation, and preventing its wealth from being siphoned overseas by predatory industrial nations, Gandhi's proposal is arguably very efficient indeed. And this, in turn, was what brought it to the attention of E.F. Schumacher. One of Schumacher's particular talents was a gift for intellectual synthesis. His work is full of cogent insights that sum up a great deal of more specialized work and make it applicable to a wide range of circumstances. This is what he did with Gandhi's ideas. Schumacher argued that talk about, quote, developing the third world, unquote, typically neglected to deal with one of the most pragmatic issues of all, the cost of setting up workers with the tools they needed to work. An example will help explore his logic. You are the president of the newly independent nation of Imaginaria. You've got a population that's not particularly well-fed, clothed, and housed, and a high unemployment rate. You've got a very modest budget for economic development. Your nation, however, has raw materials of various kinds, which could be used to feed, clothe, and house the Imaginarian people. Your foreign economic advisors, who not coincidentally come from the industrial nation that used to be your country's imperial overlord, insist that your best option is to use your budget to build a big modern factory that will turn those raw materials into goods for export to the industrial nation by its own merchants, giving your country cash income to buy goods from them, and in the process employing a few thousand Imaginarians as factory workers. Not so fast, says Schumacher. If your goal is to feed, clothe, house, and employ the Imaginarian people, building a factory is a very inefficient way to go about it, because that approach requires a very large investment per worker employed. You can provide many more Imaginarians with productive jobs for the same amount of money by turning to a technology that's less expensive to build, maintain, and supply with energy and raw materials, say by providing them with hand tools and workbenches instead of state-of-the-art fabrication equipment, and setting up supply chains that supply them with local raw materials instead of imports from abroad. The goods those workers produce may not be suitable for export, but that's not necessarily a problem. Remember, your goal is to feed, clothe, and house Imaginarians so they will re-elect you, and maximizing production for domestic use will make you more popular in the Imaginarian street, since less of the value produced by those workers will be skimmed off by the middlemen who manage in international trade. Furthermore, since your nation won't have to trade with overseas producers for as many of the necessities of life, the need for cash from overseas goes down, and you get an economy less vulnerable to foreign exchange shocks into the bargain. This was the basis for what Schumacher called intermediate technology, and the younger generation of activist inventors who followed in his footsteps called appropriate technology. Their idea was that relatively simple technologies, powered by locally available energy sources and drawing on locally available raw materials, could provide paying jobs and an improved standard of living for working people throughout the Third World. A lot of productive thinking went into these projects, and there were impressive success stories before the counter-revolution of the 1980s cut what little funding the movement had been able to find. Mind you, Schumacher's thinking was never popular among economists or the business world, and it happened more than once that countries that tried to adopt such economic policies were treated to the sort of attitude adjustments mentioned earlier. Still, pay attention to those Third World nations that have succeeded in becoming relatively prosperous, and you'll find that some version of Schumacher's scheme played a significant role in helping them do that. It's when the same logic is applied to the industrial world, though, that Schumacher's ideas become most relevant to the project of this book. As the economies of the industrial world begin to take on features until recently confined to the non-industrial world, thinking designed for the non-industrial world may be a good deal more applicable here and now than the conventional wisdom might suggest. It seems utterly improbable that the governments of today's industrial powers will have the foresight, or for that matter, the common sense, to realize that economic policies that deliberately increase the number of people earning a living might be a very good idea in an age of pervasive structural unemployment. Or for that matter, to glimpse the unraveling of the industrial age and realize that within a finite amount of time, the choice will no longer be between high-tech and low-tech ways of manufacturing goods, but between low-tech ways and no way at all. Still, national governments are not the only players in the game. What Schumacher proposed, in fact, is one of the missing pieces to the puzzle of sustainability in an age of industrial decline. The economies of scale that made centralized mass production possible in recent decades were simply one more side effect of the vast amounts of energy the industrial nations burnt up during that time. As fossil fuel depletion brings those excesses to an end, the energy and other resources needed to maintain centralized mass production will no longer be available, and what I've described above as the economics of the real world come into play. At that point, the question of how much it costs to equip a worker to do a given job becomes a central economic issue, because any resources that have to go to equipping that worker must be taken away from other productive use. In the twilight of the age of cheap energy, the most abundant energy source remaining throughout the world will be human labor. And as other resources become more costly, the price of labor, and thus the wages that can be earned by it, will drop accordingly. At the same time, human labor has certain crucial advantages in a world of energy scarcity, just as it did in earlier eras of economic contraction and social decline. Unlike other technologies, human labor is fueled by food, which is a form of solar energy. Our agricultural system produces food using fossil fuels, but this is a habit of the age of abundant energy. Field labor by human beings with simple tools, paid at close to third world wages, already plays a crucial role in the production of many crops in the U.S., and this will only increase as wages drop and fuel prices rise. The agriculture of the future, like agriculture in any thickly populated society with few energy resources, will thus use land intensively rather than extensively, rely on human labor with hand tools rather than more energy-intensive methods, and produce bulk vegetable crops and relatively modest amounts of animal protein. The agricultural systems of medieval China and Japan, chronicled by F.H. King in Farmers of 40 Centuries, are as good a model as any. Such an agricultural system will not support 7 billion people, but then neither will anything else, and a decline in population as malnutrition becomes common and public health collapses is a fairly safe bet for the not-too-distant future. For similar reasons, the economies of the future will make use of human labor rather than any of the currently fashionable mechanical or electronic technologies as their principal means for getting things done. Partly this will happen because, in an overly crowded world where all of the resources are scarce and costly, human labor will be the cheapest resource available, but it draws on other factors as well. This was pointed out many years ago by Lewis Mumford in The Myth of the Machine. He argued that the revolutionary change that gave rise to the first urban civilizations was not agriculture or literacy or any of the other things most often cited in this context. Instead, he proposed, that change was the invention of the world's first machine, a machine distinguished from all others in that all of its parts were human beings. Call it an army, a labor gang, a bureaucracy, or the first stirrings of a factory system, in these cases and more, it consisted of a group of people able to work together in unison. All later machines, he suggested, were attempts to make inanimate things display the singleness of purpose that a line of harvesters reaping barley or a work gang hauling a stone into place on a pyramid. This kind of machine has huge advantages in a world of abundant population and scarce resources. It is, among other things, a very efficient means of producing the food that fuels it and the other items needed by its component parts. And it is also very efficient at maintaining and reproducing itself. As a means of turning solar energy into productive labor, it is less efficient than current technologies. But its simplicity, its resilience, and its ability to cope with widely varying inputs give it a potent edge over these in a time of turbulence and social decay. This kind of machine, it deserves to be said, is profoundly repellent to many people in the industrial world, doubtless including many of those who are reading this book. It's interesting to think about why this should be so, especially when some examples of the machine at work, Amish barn raisings come to mind, have gained iconic status in the alternative scene. It's not going too far, I think, to point out that the word community, which receives so much lip service these days, is in many ways another word for Mumford's primal machine. For the last few centuries, we have tried replacing that machine with a dizzying assortment of others, instead of subordinating individual desires to collective needs. Like every previous society, we have built a surrogate community of machines powered by coal and oil and natural gas to take care, however sporadically, of our collective needs. As those resources deplete, societies used to directing non-human energy according to scientific principles will face the challenge of learning once again how to direct human energy according to older and less familiar laws. This can be done in relatively humane ways, or in starkly inhumane ones. What remains to be seen is where along the spectrum the societies of the future will fall. Becoming a third world country. Recognizing that the ideas of Schumacher crafted for the newly independent nations of his own time are increasingly relevant to the industrial nations of the present, however, is only one part of a broader and even less welcome realization. The recognition that perhaps the best way to describe the changes ahead is to say that most of the world's industrial nations are in the process of becoming third world countries. For all its current power and wealth, the United States is firmly in the lead of that transition. What distinguishes the world's non-industrial countries from the privileged industrial minority of the world's nations? Third world nations import most of their manufactured goods from abroad and export mostly raw materials. That's been true of the United States for decades now. Third world economies have inadequate domestic capital and are dependent upon loans from abroad. That's been true of the United States for just about as long. Third world societies are economically burdened by severe problems with public health. The United States ranks dead last for life expectancy among industrial nations, and its rates of infant mortality are on par with those in Indonesia, so that's covered. Third world nations are very often governed by kleptocracies that run the affairs of government for the private benefit of the few, and a strong case can be made that this, too, is currently the state of affairs in the United States. There are, in fact, precisely two things left that differentiate the United States from any other large, overpopulated, impoverished third world nation. The first is that the average standard of living in the United States, measured either in money or in terms of energy and resource consumption, stands well above third world levels. In fact, it's well above the levels of most other industrial nations. The second is that the United States has the world's most expensive and technologically complex military. Those two factors are closely related, and understanding their relationship is crucial in making sense of the end of the American century and the decline of the United States, along with other industrial nations, to third world status. The U.S. has the world's most expensive military because, just now, it has the world's largest empire. It's not considered polite to talk about American global hegemony in these terms, but the U.S. does not keep its troops garrisoned in 140 countries around the world for the sake of their health. The U.S. empire functions, like other empires, as a way of tilting economic relationships between nations so that wealth flows out of the rest of the world and into the coffers of the imperial nation. It never occurs to most Americans to wonder why it is that 5% of the world's population who live in the U.S. get to use around one-third of the world's production of industrial products. The economics of empire are the reason why. A century ago, in 1910, Britain had the global empire, the worldwide garrisons, and the torrents of wealth flowing from around the world to boost the British standard of living at the expense of everyone else. A century from now, in 2110, if the technology to maintain a worldwide empire still exists, and it can be done with a much simpler technological basis, Spain managed to build the world empire with no technology more complex than wooden sailing ships and crude cannons. Somebody else will be in that position. It won't be America, because empire is the methamphetamine of nations. In the short term, the effects feel great, but in the long term, they're lethal. Britain managed to walk away from its empire without catastrophe because the United States was willing and able to take over and give Britain a place in the inner circle of U.S. allies into the bargain. Most other nations have paid for their imperial overshoot with a century or two of economic collapse, political chaos, and social disintegration. The economics of empire also explains why it is that so many people in the industrial world believe that it makes sense for them to consume much more in the ways of goods and services than they produce. During much of the industrial era, a good fraction of Europe did get away with consuming more than it produced by the simple expedient of owning most of the rest of the world and exploiting it for their own economic benefit. As late as 1914, the vast majority of the world's land surface was either ruled directly from a European capital, occupied by people of European descent, or dominated by European power through some form of radically unequal treaty relationship. The accelerating drawdown of fossil fuels over the last three centuries shifted the process into overdrive, allowing the minority of the Earth's population who lived in Europe, or the more privileged nations of European diaspora, the United States first among them, not only adopt what were, by all standards of all previous human societies, extravagantly lavish lifestyles, but to expect that those lifestyles would become ever more lavish in the future. I don't think that more than a handful of people in the industrial world have yet begun to deal with the hard fact that those days are over. European domination of the globe, the first source of Euro-American wealth and power, came apart explosively in the four brutal decades between 1914, when the First World War broke out, and 1954, when the fall of French Indonesia put a period to the age of European empire. The United States, which inherited what was left of Europe's imperial role, never achieved the level of global dominance that European nations took for granted until 1914. Compare the British Empire, which directly ruled a quarter of the Earth's land surface, with the hole and corner arrangements that allow America to maintain garrisons in other people's countries around the world today, and the difference is hard to miss. Now, the second and arguably more important source of Euro-American wealth and power, the exploitation of 500 million years of prehistoric sunlight in the form of fossil fuels, has peaked and entered its own decline, with consequences that bid fair to be at least as drastic as those that followed the shattering of the Pax Europa in 1914. Thus, the end of the bubble of industrialism is made more complex by the end of the bubble of America's political and economic hegemony over the rest of the planet. Like every other empire, we have a tribute economy. We dress it up in free market clothing by giving our trading partners mountains of worthless paper in return for the torrents of real wealth that flow into the U.S. every day. But the result, now as in the past, is that the imperial nation and its inner circle of allies have a vast surplus of wealth sloshing through their economies. This has had massive social impacts, since handing over a little of that extra wealth to the poor and the working class has proven to be a tolerably effective way to maintain some semblance of social order. This habit has been around nearly as long as empires themselves. The Romans were particularly adept at it. Bread and circuses is the famous phrase for their policy of providing free food and entertainment to the Roman urban poor to keep them docile. Starting in the wake of the last Great Depression, when many wealthy people woke up to the fact that their wealth did not protect them against bombs tossed through windows, most industrial nations have done the same thing by ratcheting up working-class incomes, providing benefits such as old-age pensions, and providing plenty of free entertainment in such forms as broadcast television. What passes by the name of democracy in most industrial nations, as a result, is a system in which factions of the political class buy votes from pressure groups by handing out what the American political slang of an earlier day called by the endearing term pork. An economy capable of expanding the money supply at will provided ample resources for political pork vendors, and the resulting outpouring of pig products formed a rising tide that, as the saying goes, lifted all boats. The problem faced by the United States in this context is the same one that brought repeated economic crises to the British Empire, the Spanish Empire, and many other examples in history. The flood of wealth brought into an imperial economy drives up wages, and when wages in the imperial nation rise far enough above those of its neighbors, it stops being profitable to hire people in that nation for any task that can be done outside it. The result is a society in which those who get access to pork prosper, and those who don't are left twisting in the wind. Arnold Toynbee, whose monumental study of the rise and fall of empires remains the most detailed examination of the process, calls these latter the internal proletariat, those who live within a society but no longer share in its benefits and become increasingly disaffected from its ideals and institutions. In the near term, they are the natural fodder of demagogues. In the longer term, they make common cause with the external proletariat, those peoples outside the borders whose labor and resources have become essential to the economy of a dominant state, but who receive no benefits from that economy, and play a key role in bringing the whole system crashing down. That's the corner into which the United States has backed itself. The flood of lightly disguised tribute from overseas, while it made Americans fantastically wealthy by the standards of the rest of the world, also gutted America's domestic economy and created a culture of entitlement that includes all classes from the bottom to the social pyramid right up to the top. As always happens, sooner or later, the benefits of empire are failing to keep pace with its rising costs, and in addition, rising demands for imperial largesse from all parts of society are drawing down an increasingly straited supply of wealth. Meanwhile, other nations with imperial ambitions are circling like sharks. The wisest among them know that time is on their side, and that any additional burden that can be loaded onto a drowning empire will hasten the day when it goes under for the third time, and they can close in for the kill. The twilight of American empire. This view of the world situation gets little space in the cultural mainstream, or for that matter, in any of the self-proclaimed alternative scenes. The contrast with a century ago is instructive. Many people in late imperial Britain knew well that the empire, on which the sun famously never set, critics suggested that this was because God himself wouldn't trust an Englishman in the dark, had had its day and was itself setting. The lines of Rudyard Kipling's poem, Recessional, simply put in powerful imagery what many people were thinking at the time. Far called, our navies melt away. On dune and headland sinks the fire. Lo, all our pomp of yesterday is one with Nineveh and Tyre. You won't find the same sort of historical sense widespread nowadays, though. And the power of the modern world's secular religion of progress has a great deal to do with it. In 1910, the concept of historical decline was on a great many minds. These days, you'll hardly hear it mentioned, because the belief in history as perpetual progress has become all the more entrenched, as the foundations that made the progress of recent centuries possible have rotted away. The resulting insistence on seeing all social changes through onward and upward colored spectacles has imposed huge distortions on our perceptions of recent events. One good example is the rise and fall of the so-called global economy in recent decades. Its proponents portray it as the triumphal wave of a utopian future that would enable everybody to live like middle-class Americans. Its critics portrayed it as the equally triumphant metastasis of a monolithic corporate power out to enslave the world. Very few people saw it as the desperate gambit of a failing imperial society that could no longer afford to run its own economy and was forced to outsource even its most basic economic functions to the poorer nine-tenths of the world. Nonetheless, this last is what it has turned out to be, and several other nations predictably used the influx of capital and technology to build their own industrial sectors, bide their time, and then enter the market themselves and outcompete the very companies and countries that gave them a foot in the door. More broadly, it seems to have escaped the attention of a great many observers that the day of the multinational corporation is drawing to an end. The struggle over Russia's energy resources was the decisive battle there, and when Vladimir Putin crushed the Western-funded oligarchs and turned control of his country's energy supply back to its government, that battle was settled with a typical Russian sense of drama. The elegance with which China has turned international trade law against its putative beneficiaries is just as typical. A flurry of corporations owned by the Chinese government have spread their operations throughout the world, using the mechanisms of global trade to lay the foundations of a future Chinese global empire, while the Chinese government has efficiently stonewalled any further trade negotiations that would have put Chinese economic interests at home in jeopardy. More recently, China has begun buying sizable stakes in the multinational corporations that so many well-meaning people in the West once thought would reduce the world to vassalage. The day when ExxonMobil is a wholly owned subsidiary of China National Offshore Oil Corporation may be closer than it looks. The same biases that make such global changes invisible have impacts at least as sweeping here in North America. Faith in progress, coupled with the tribute economy's culture of entitlement, have made it nearly impossible for anybody in public life to talk about the hard fact that America can no longer afford most of the social habits it adopted during its age of empire. It's impossible to think of an aspect of daily life that will not be changed drastically as a result. We will have to give up the notion, for example, that most people in the industrial world ought to go to college and get a meaningful and fulfilling job of the sort that can be done sitting at a desk. We will have to abandon the idea that it makes any sense to spend $250,000 giving an elderly person with an incurable disease 6 more months of life. We will have to relearn the old distinction between the deserving poor, those who are willing to work and simply need the opportunity, or who have fallen into destitution through circumstances outside their control, and those who are simply trying to game the system. The great majority of us will get to find out what it's like to make things instead of buying them, even when that means a sharp reduction in quality, to skip meals or make do with very little, because the money to pay for anything more simply isn't there, and to treat serious illnesses at home because care from a doctor costs too much. I could go on for paragraphs, but I trust you get the idea. All these changes, it needs to be said, would be inevitable at this point, even if the industrial world depended on renewable resources and had a stable, sustainable relationship with the planetary biosphere that supports all of our lives. The United States has played its recent hands in the game of empire very badly, indeed, and it has responded to each loss by doubling down and raising the stakes even higher. This does not offer much hope for a future of stability. The global context of the crisis, though, also needs to be kept in mind. The industrial world does not depend on renewable resources, and its relationship with the biosphere is leading it straight down the well-worn path of overshoot and collapse. The endgame of American empire, while it would be taking place anyway, has the additional factor of the limits to growth in play. In an alternative world where energy and resource flows could be counted on to remain stable for the foreseeable future, it's quite possible that one of the rising powers might offer America the same devil's bargain that we offered Britain in 1942, and prop up the hulk of our empire just long enough to take it over for themselves. As it is, it cannot have escaped the attention of any other nation that something like a quarter of the world's dwindling resource supplies could be available for other countries if only the United States were to lose the ability to get energy and other resources from outside its own borders. Plenty of nations would profit mightily from such a readjustment, and nothing so unseemly as a global war would necessarily be required to make it happen. To name only one possibility, it's by no means unthinkable that the United States, having manufactured color revolutions, quote-unquote, to order in countries around the world, might turn out to be vulnerable to the same sort of well-organized mob action here at home. Exactly how things will play out in the months and years to come is anybody's guess. One of the consequences of America's descent into third world status, though, is that a great many of us may have scant leisure to contemplate global and national issues amid the struggle to keep food on the table and a roof over our heads. In the long run, this shift in focus may have certain advantages. Those nations that undergo the transition soonest and thus forced to learn how to get by on modest energy and resource flows available in the absence of fossil fuels may find that this gives them a head start in making changes that everyone else will have to make in due time. Still, making the most of those advantages will require a different approach to economics, among other things, than most of us have pursued or imagined pursuing so far. Survival isn't cost-effective. Economic factors have played a massive role in putting the industrial world in its current predicament, and play an even more substantial role in blocking any constructive attempt to get out of the corner into which we've painted ourselves. There's all too real a sense in which if modern industrial civilization perishes, it will be because the steps necessary for its survival weren't cost-effective enough. Mind you, this can be interpreted in at least two different ways, as a statement of economic theory or as a statement of practical experience, and both of them are relevant to the crisis of the industrial world. Like any other science, economics is a set of hypothetical models that reflect, with more or less exactness, the observed behavior of the world. Too often, though, the models get confused with the reality, and understanding suffers. This has to be kept in mind when trying to make sense of the economic dimension of industrial civilization's decline and fall, because both sides of the equation, the models and the reality, throw up challenges in the way of constructive action. So do economic policies that are based on the models, and thus function at a second remove from reality. It's true, of course, that current economic theory has lost touch with reality in critical ways, and a revision of some of the basic ideas of modern economics is essential if we're to make sense of our predicament and do anything constructive in response to it. It's equally true that government policies based on today's misguided economic notions have become massive liabilities to societies struggling to deal with today's crisis. And even this late in the game, changes in these policies might still do a great deal of good. Still, it's also true that economic factors in the real world, independent of theory, impose hard limits on what can be done. This has particular applicability to the current crisis of industrial society. The grim scenario traced out in the seminal 1973 study, The Limits to Growth, still the most plausible map of the future ahead of us, and thus inevitably the most bitterly vilified, is driven by simple economics. An industrial economy pursuing limitless growth in a finite world, that study pointed out, will have to contend with a steadily depleting resource base and rising pollution generated by the process of industrial production. As resources deplete, the costs of keeping them flowing into the economy will increase in real terms, as more labor and capital have to be invested to extract a given amount of each resource. As pollution levels rise, in turn, the costs of mitigating their impacts on public health, agricultural productivity, and other core economic factors go up in the same way and for the same reasons. Those costs have to be paid out of the current economic output, leaving less and less for other uses, until economic output itself begins to fall and the industrial world begins its terminal decline. Now, I'm going to read this paragraph again because this is a fabulous, quick summary of the significance of the book, The Limits to Growth. The grim scenario traced out in the seminal 1973 study, The Limits to Growth, still the most plausible map of the future ahead of us, and thus inevitably the most bitterly vilified, is driven by simple economics. An industrial economy pursuing limitless growth in a finite world, that study pointed out, will have to contend with a steadily depleting resource base and rising pollution generated by the process of industrial production. As resources deplete, the cost of keeping them flowing into the economy will increase in real terms, as more capital and labor have to be invested to extract a given amount of each resource. As pollution levels rise, in turn, the costs of mitigating their impacts on public health, agricultural productivity, and other core economic factors go up in the same way and for the same reasons. Those costs have to be paid out of current economic output, leaving less and less for other uses, until economic output itself begins to fall and the industrial world begins its terminal decline. Now, it's easy to insist, if you ignore the economic dimension, that a society facing this sort of crisis can save itself by launching a massive program to build nuclear reactors, solar thermal power plants, algal biodiesel, or what have you. And of course, this sort of claim has seen endless rehashing over the last couple of decades. The problem is that massive programs of this sort pile additional demands on an already faltering economy and resource base. Any such program has to be paid for, after all. And by this, I don't mean that money has to be found for it. In today's hallucinatory economic climate, conjuring money out of thin air is easy enough. No, it has to be paid out of current resource stocks and economic output, which are much less flexible and already have to cover the rising costs of resource depletion and pollution. This is the trap hidden in the limits to growth. Once those limits begin to bite, the spare economic capacity that would be needed to build a way out of trouble no longer exists. Nor is it possible to avoid such economic challenges by embracing such options as the lifeboat communities proposed so often in recent years. The basic idea seems plausible enough at first glance. To preserve lives and knowledge through the decline and fall of the industrial civilization by establishing a network of self-sufficient communities in isolated rural areas equipped with the tools and technology they will need to maintain a tolerable standard of living in difficult times. The trouble comes, as it usually does, when it's time to tote up the bill. The average lifeboat community project would cost well over $10 million to establish. Many would cost a great deal more. And I have yet to see such a project that provides any means for its inhabitants to cover those costs and pay their bills in the years before industrial civilization goes away. The unstated assumption seems to be that as soon as the intrepid residents of such a community move into their solar-heated co-housing units, start up the wind turbines and the methane generators, and get to work harvesting tree crops from the permacultured landscape all around, industrial civilization will disappear in a puff of smoke and take its taxes, debts, and miscellaneous expenses with it. Pleasant though the prospect might seem, I'm sorry to say this isn't going to happen. The residents of any lifeboat community founded today will not only have to come up somehow with the very substantial sums needed to buy the land, build the co-housing units, wind turbines, and so on, and plant all that permaculture landscaping, they will also have to earn a living during the long transitional period that leads from the world we inhabit today to the conditions that will pertain at the bottom of the curve of decline. Some awareness of those difficulties may go a long way to help to explain why, of the great number of lifeboat communities that have been proposed over the last decade or two, the number that have been built and counted can be counted on the fingers of one foot. Thus, there are limits hardwired into our situation by the inflexible realities that surround us, and we have already strayed far enough over those limits that the payback will inevitably be harsh. The alternative path traced by Schumacher's concept of intermediate technology and the many practical applications of that concept devised in the years since his time offer one of the few options for easing the burden of that payback. That path has the further advantage, as already mentioned, that it can be put into practice right now by individuals, families, communities, and working groups of various kinds. It need not wait on any collective action by government or society. Still, there are some collective changes that might also be worth pursuing, even this late in the game, and these will form the theme of this book's final chapter. Chapter 6. The Road Ahead. Many people nowadays assume that the collapse of the current economic order in the industrial world must lead to mass death and a descent into savagery. This hardly follows. Most of the world's nations have undergone political and social collapse at least once in the course of the last century. The process can certainly be traumatic, but it isn't the end of the world. Whatever crises drive today's industrial order to its end, and whatever national or international traumas supervene until some degree of stability returns, there will be a place for new politics when the future governments of today's industrial nations, or the governments of the new political units that emerge from the wreckage, get to work picking up the pieces. This does not mean that all of today's problems can be solved by a change in politics, or for that matter, of politicians. An article of faith in many circles today holds that everything that's wrong in the world is the fault of the institutions or personalities in charge, and can be fixed by replacing them with some other set of institutions or personalities. That notion has been tested more thoroughly by history than any other hypothesis in the social sciences, and it has pretty consistently failed. It seems likely to help matters considerably if we accept that people will not behave like angels no matter how or whether they are governed, or who, if anyone, does the governing, and if, in the process, we admit that human beings are incurably human, that is, capable of the full spectrum of good and evil all by themselves, rather than moral puppets who can be expected to dance on command to the tune of a good or evil system. It's easy to come up with a perfect system of human society, in other words, so long as it doesn't have to work in the real world. And it's very easy to compare the glories of a perfect system as it exists on paper to the failings of a system in the real world. Nearly always, though, what John Kenneth Galbraith said about innovation in finance is just as true of innovation in political and social institutions. What gets ballyhooed as new and revolutionary thinking is normally the repetition of a fairly small set of fallacies that worked very poorly the last dozen times or so that they were tried, and will work just as poorly this time, too. Those systems that function at all are fairly few in number, though there are plenty of variations on the basic themes. And the ones that have become standard in the world's industrial nations, representative democracy in politics, a mixed market system in economics, have certain advantages. Though the current examples of these systems are troubled, corrupt, and at risk of being overwhelmed by the consequences of bad decisions made over the last few decades, they have still shown themselves to be less dysfunctional most of the time than most of the alternatives that have actually been tried. There's a reason for this. Though they are rarely recognized as such, societies and economies are natural systems. They are as natural to human beings as hives are to bees or packs to wolves, and the process of evolution and selection that have shaped them over time are much the same as the processes that shape the social behavior of other animals. One of the crucial lessons today's environmental crisis is teaching us is that natural systems do not take well to being restructured from the ground up to fit human notions. The evidence of history suggests that with societies, as with other natural systems, change happens most successfully by way of simple mutations rather than complete reshapings. The expansion of civil rights over the last century and a half is a case in point. A set of rights and responsibilities that worked well when applied to a relatively small group of people, in the case of the United States, white men who owned property, has proven to work even better when extended to the adult population as a whole. Meanwhile, attempts to overturn the entire structure of society at once, for example the French and Russian revolutions, failed to produce anything but an explosion of violence and tyranny. Thus, no grandiose plan for the complete transformation of everything, of the sort that have been in vogue among social reformers for so many years, will be presented here. Instead, I will suggest a handful of limited, tightly focused changes, mutations, if you will, that could have a real chance, if implemented, of canceling out some of the self-defeating habits of the current economic system and replacing them with effective incentives toward the habits industrial societies need to establish. Many of the forces pushing us toward collapse are a product of the economic mistakes already discussed in this book, and in the ways those mistakes are reflected in public policy. Those could conceivably be changed in time to matter. The transition from an economy of abundance that defined the recent past to the economy of scarcity that will define the near future bids fair to open a window of opportunity for change, though this in itself does not guarantee that the changes in question will be for the better. The accumulated burdens of past mistakes weigh heavily enough on the future that changes of this sort won't stave off a great deal of trouble and suffering. But it's possible that a shift to saner policies, backed by more realistic economic ideas, could cushion the end of the age of abundance and make it easier to allocate resources to projects that will actually do some good, instead of pursuing policies which, like nearly all of the economic policies currently in place in the industrial world, will simply make matters worse. In the following pages, I propose to suggest some of the possibilities still open to the industrial world. Remembering what worked. At the head of the list of useful steps belongs the recognition that governments might find it useful to stop making the predicament of the industrial world worse than it already is. The decision of the U.S. government to deal with the immediate impacts of the 2008 real estate crash by what is euphemistically called quantitative easing, and is better known as printing money, is a case in point. Nearly every penny of the money voted by Congress and conjured into being by the Federal Reserve was given to the same huge banks and financial corporations that caused the real estate bubble in the first place. Some of that money went into bailouts of financial corporations. Some of it was used to subsidize new and refinanced mortgages for consumers, in the hope that these could be used to prop up one set of unpayable debts with another. The result, in both cases, has been the perpetuation of the same disastrous imbalances that helped spawn the housing bubble in the first place, while flooding the tertiary economy with even higher levels of unpayable debt. Such antics have given additional fuel to those who claim that government has no business taking action affecting the market at all. Still, the fact that competent doctors maim and kill their patients on occasion does not mean that all medical care is a bad idea. Markets, despite their benefits, are not uniquely gifted with a perfect ability to make economic decisions. This has become a controversial point in recent years. Just as a great many people on the left have picked up the dubious habit of using labels such as fascism for any political system to the right of Hillary Clinton, a great many people on the right seem to have convinced themselves that any form of economic regulation at all is tantamount to some sort of neo-Marxist hobgoblin. It seems to have been forgotten that a spectrum exists of something other than its two endpoints. Drowning, however, is not the only alternative to dying of dehydration. There's a middle ground that is noticeably more pleasant than either. The same principle applies in economics. The experiment of having government own all the means of production in an industrial society along the lines proposed by Marx received a thorough test at the hands of the communist bloc and failed abjectly to produce the benefits Marx claimed it would produce. At the same time, the experiment of having government keep its hands off the economy altogether in an industrial society along the lines proposed by a great many free market proponents these days received an equally thorough test and failed just as dismally. In America, that test ran from the end of the Civil War into the first decade of the 20th century, and the result was a catastrophic series of booms and busts. The transfer of most of the nation's wealth to a tiny minority of wealthy people, the bitter impoverishment of nearly everyone else, and a level of social unrest that included two presidential assassinations and so many bomb attacks on the rich and their families that bomb-throwing anarchists became a regular theme of music hall songs. It's always possible for theorists to contrast a utopian portrait of a free market economy against the gritty and unwelcome realities of extreme socialism, just as it's possible for people on the other side of the spectrum to contrast a utopian portrait of a socialist economy with the equally grim and unwelcome realities of unfettered capitalism. Both make great rhetorical strategies, since the human mind is easily misled by binary logic. If A is evil, it seems wholly reasonable to claim that the opposite of A must be good. The real world does not work that way, but this is hardly the only case in which rhetoric ignores reality. Thus, it simply isn't true that the best, or for that matter the only alternative, to the unchecked rule of corporate robber barons is Marxist-style state ownership of the economy. Once again, dying from heat stroke is not the only alternative to dying from hypothermia. It means rather that something between these two extremes might be worth trying, especially if it can be shown by historical evidence to work tolerably well in practice. Of course, this is what history does show. Broadly speaking, economies that leave the means of production in private hands, but use appropriate regulation to harness their energies to the public good, consistently produce more prosperity for more people than either unfettered capitalism or extreme socialism. This being said, the midpoint between these extremes may not lie where today's conventional wisdom tends to place it. Consider an example from the not-too-distant past. A large industrial nation with a capitalist economy that had remarkably tough regulations restricting the growth of private fortunes and the abuses to which capitalist economies are so often prone. The wealthiest people in that nation paid more than 90% of their annual income in tax, and monopolistic practices on the part of corporations faced harsh and frequently applied judicial penalties. The financial sector was particularly tightly leashed. Interest rates on savings accounts were fixed by the government. Usury laws put very low caps on interest rates for loans, and legal barriers prevented banks from expanding out of local markets or crossing the firewall between consumer banking and the riskier world of corporate investment. Consumer credit was so difficult to get as a result that most people did without it most of the time, using layaway plans and Christmas club savings programs to afford large purchases. According to the standard rhetoric of free market proponents these days, so rigidly controlled an economy ought by definition to be hopelessly stagnant and unproductive. This shows once again the separation of rhetoric from reality, however. For the nation I have just described was the United States during the presidency of Dwight D. Eisenhower, that is, during one of the most sustained periods of prosperity, innovation, economic development, and international influence this nation has ever seen. Now, of course, there were many other factors behind America's 1950s success, just as there were other factors behind the decline since then. Still, it's worth noting that as the economic regulations of the 1950s have been dismantled, in every case under the pretext of boosting America's prosperity, the prosperity of most Americans has gone down, not up. The economic regulations that shaped the American economy in the 1950s had a curious dimension, though. Outside of antitrust legislation, very little of it applied to the economy of goods and services on any level, whether that of mom-and-pop grocery stores or big industrial conglomerates. The bulk of it, and very nearly all of the strictest elements in it, focused on the financial industry. In the terms used in this book, instead of regulating the production and consumption of goods and services in the secondary economy, the economic policies of the Eisenhower era focused on regulating the tertiary economy, ensuring that too much tertiary wealth did not end up concentrated unproductively in too few hands, and controlling its propensity to multiply as enthusiastically as rabbits on Viagra. That distinction between a relatively unregulated secondary economy and a tightly controlled tertiary economy seems to have worked fairly well, just as the removal of all limits on the tertiary economy has consistently ended very badly. It makes a good measure of how far the United States has come as a nation that the economic policies of one of the most successful 20th century Republican administrations would be rejected by most of today's Democrats as too far to the left. A case could be made, in fact, that far and away the most sensible thing the U.S. Congress could do today in the face of an economy that has very nearly choked to death on its own bubbles is to reenact the economic legislation in place in the 1950s, line for line. Such proposals outrage the common conviction that going backwards is a bad thing. Still, when you're hiking in the woods and discover that you've taken a trail that leads someplace you don't want to go, your best bet is normally to turn around and go back to the last place where you were still going in the right direction. Defending the commons. This strategy of returning to ways of doing things that have worked in the past, however, will not address the conflict between the limitless tertiary economy and the hard limits of the primary economy, which is the ultimate driving force behind the crisis in industrial society. As we've seen, resource depletion imposes costs, and often drastic ones, on the economy. Under current economic arrangements, however, those costs are not charged to the people who benefit from the activities in question. The owner of an oil well, for example, gets the economic benefits of pumping oil out of the ground, but does not have to pay for the impact that today's extraction will have on tomorrow's economy. For many years, in fact, government policies in many industrial nations have actually rewarded oil well owners for accelerating the depletion of the resource and imposing massive costs on the future. In the same way, the owner of a smokestack that dumps pollution into the atmosphere gets the economic benefits of whatever activity produces the pollution, but does not have to pay for any of the costs incurred throughout the economy as a result of the pollution. This asymmetry has at least two results. First, and most obvious, neither the oil well owner nor the smokestack owner has any economic incentive to decrease the negative impacts of his or her activities. Second, the long-term economic burdens of depletion and pollution are not included in measures of the costs of the well or the smokestack. The result is a massive distortion in our understanding of the realities that shape our lives. It's generally not considered a viable business plan, outside of today's financial industry, that is, to make large profits in the short term by running up debts so large the business will have to declare bankruptcy in the not-too-distant future. Yet this is exactly what an economic system that ignores the cumulative costs of resource depletion and pollution is doing, on an even larger scale. The future costs of extracting resources from depleted reserves and mitigating the impacts of a polluted environment have the same effect as the future costs of debt service on excessive borrowing. They make the act of buying temporary prosperity in the near future a cause of impoverishment or collapse further down the road. Garrett Hardin's The Tragedy of the Commons, as already discussed, addresses the same issue. Hardin showed that when the benefits from exploiting a resource went to individuals, but the costs were spread throughout the community, individuals intent on maximizing their own individual benefit would overexploit the resource and cause the whole community to suffer drastic losses in the longer run. His logic was impeccable, and there are plenty of real-world examples of resource exhaustion driven by this very process. But it has been pointed out by his critics that resources held in common have in fact been managed sustainably in countless cases around the world and throughout history. The question that has to be asked is where the difference comes in. This is where the divide pointed up earlier, the gap between economic realities and the models our society uses to understand them and predict their effects, comes into play. Hardin was quite correct that when individuals get the benefits of resource exploitation without paying their fair share of the costs to the community, exhaustion of the resource follows. Those societies that have managed their commons successfully, in turn, found ways of making those who gained the benefits of resource exploitation pay a commensurate share of the costs. The collective understanding of economics in these societies, in other words, and the social policies that they adopted to shape economic behavior, took the tragedy of the commons into account and adjusted the laws and customs governing economic exchanges accordingly. Several thoughtful proposals have been circulated over the years to match up costs and benefits. None of these proposals are likely to be popular anytime soon, since the average voter in the industrial world receives substantial benefits from the maltreatment of the primary economy of nature while avoiding most of the costs. To name only one example, the benefits of automobile transportation and central heating do not come with a bill for the air pollution these activities produce. Still, costs for other forms of commons are already shared by most people in the industrial world on a pay-as-you-go basis. Power and sewer bills come to mind as examples. And the same principle may be worth proposing to deal with the costs of maintaining natural commons as well. The acronym TANSTAAFL, T-A-N-S-T-A-A-F-L, short for There Ain't No Such Thing as a Free Lunch, popularized by Robert Heinlein in his science fiction novel, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, makes a good slogan for this approach. The entire industrial world has been treating the primary economy of nature as a source of free lunches for the last three centuries or so, with increasingly problematic results. One of the reasons why it's important to treat the natural world as an economic force in its own right, the primary economy in the terminology used in this book, is precisely the need to begin reckoning up harm to the natural systems as an economic cost that has to be dealt with in analysis of cost and benefits, not an externality that can be swept under the rug by a display of economic legerdemain. As people begin to get used to thinking of trees, bees, and mineral cycles as part of the economy that supports them and forms the unavoidable foundation for any real personal or national prosperity, the habit of treating nature as a disposable amenity will likely begin to give way to more rational and pragmatic ways of thinking. This will also require, of course, a reorientation of economic statistics. Today's figures, as discussed in detail earlier, ignore the primary economy completely, measure the secondary economy purely in terms of the tertiary, calculating production in dollars, say, rather than potatoes and haircuts, and focus obsessively on the tertiary. This fixation means that if an economic policy boosts the tertiary economy, it looks like a good thing, even if that policy harms the secondary or the primary economies, as it very often does. Thus, the choice of statistics isn't a neutral factor, or a simple one. If that choice echoes inaccurate presuppositions, for example, the fantasy that the human economy is independent of nature, it can feed those presuppositions right back in as a distorting factor into every economic decision. The solution is clear enough. Sort out primary, secondary, and tertiary inputs in the most important economic statistics. The gross domestic product forms an excellent example. Recalculating this according to the three economies just sketched out, the statisticians of some imaginary Bureau of Honest Figures might produce something like this. The gross primary product, or GPP, would be the value of all unprocessed natural products at the moment they enter the economy. Oil as it reaches the wellhead, coal as it leaves the mine, grain as it tumbles into the silo, and so on, minus all the costs incurred in drilling, mining, growing, and so on. Those belong to the secondary economy. The gross secondary product, or GSP, might be the value of all goods and services in the economy, except for raw materials from nature and financial goods and services. The gross tertiary product, or GTP, might be the value of all financial goods and services, and all money and money equivalents produced by the economy. The value of having these three numbers alongside or instead of one gross domestic product is that they can be compared to one another and their shifts relative to one another can be tracked. If the GTP balloons and the other two products stay flat or decline, for example, that doesn't mean the country is getting wealthier. It means that the tertiary economy is inflating and needs to have some air let out of it before it busts in a speculative crash. If the GSP increases while the GPP stays flat and the cost of extracting natural resources isn't soaring out of sight, then the economy is becoming more efficient at using natural resources, in which case the politicians and executives have good reason to preen themselves in public. More generally, dividing up the GDP into these components would make it much easier to differentiate between movements in the real economies of goods and services on the one hand, and the mere multiplication of abstract paper wealth on the other. Taxing the right things. Another tool that deserves more attention than it has received is the seemingly unpromising field of tax policy. It's a subject on which a great deal of nonsense abounds just now. A recent book titled The End of Prosperity, for example, claims that if the U.S. government raised taxes to a level that would actually pay for the services it provides, the result would be, as the title claims, the end of prosperity. Somehow, the authors managed to ignore the fact that in the 1950s, when American prosperity was by most measures at its all-time peak, people in the upper tax brackets paid more than 90% of their income to Uncle Sam. and that the country has by most measures been less prosperous, not more, as those tax rates have been lowered. There's a reason for that, and it ties back into the distinctions among the primary, secondary, and tertiary economies central to the argument of this book. The primary economy of nature and the secondary economy of the production of goods and services by human labor are natural systems subject to negative feedback loops that tend to hold them in balance. The tertiary economy of money and other forms of abstract wealth, by contrast, is subject to positive feedback loops that drive it out of balance and tend to unbalance the other two economies as well. The feedback loops of the tertiary economy that cause the most damage are the ones that make accumulations of paper wealth increase exponentially in value. It's thus not hard to recognize that anything that drains off those accumulations, for example, by putting them in the pockets of people who spend their money on groceries instead of more financial paper, tends to stabilize the economy. That's what the high tax rates of the 1950s did. And it's thus hardly accidental that the more drastically tax rates have been cut in the last three decades and the more tertiary wealth have been shielded from taxes by special capital gains tax rates and the like, the more drastically the tertiary economy has manifested its normal tendency to run up extremes and blow itself up in the process. Still, there are arguably more tightly focused ways to drain off excesses from the tertiary economy, and the existing tax code also meshes very poorly with the primary economy and its emerging reality of scarce resources and overburdened natural cycles. In a world where the accelerating exploitation of natural resources and the accumulation of paper wealth are major sources of problems, while the human labor at the core of the secondary economy is the most renewable resource we have, we arguably tax the wrong things. Imagine, then, a tax code that taxes the right things instead. In this imaginary code, there are no sales taxes and no taxes on income from wages, salaries, dividends, royalties, and rents. That is, no taxes on the secondary economy at all. Instead, there are two classes of taxation. The first, on the primary economy, taxes natural goods and services. The second, on the tertiary economy, taxes interest income, capital gains, and all other money made from money. The taxes on natural goods and services would follow the same rough line of logic as property taxes do at present. Here in the United States, for example, the federal government, as trustee for the American people, effectively owns all the real estate within its borders. When you buy property, what you're buying is the right to use that property within the limits of the laws and the national interest. Which is why China can't just contract with private landowners to buy a couple of disused fishing harbors on our west coast as bases for its navy. The same principle would just as reasonably apply to every other resource in the country. When you pump oil from the ground, you're depleting part of the patrimony of this nation, and you should have to pay the government for that privilege. When you dump smoke out of a tailpipe, equally, you're using the nation's atmosphere as a kind of gaseous landfill, and you should have to pay to do that. Every natural resource of every kind under this system would thus be subject to an extraction or a pollution tax. Resources mined in other countries and imported, whether in raw form or in its finished products, would be subject to an equivalent tariff to prevent manufacturers from stripping the resources of other countries in an attempt to avoid these taxes. The taxes would apply at the point where raw materials from the primary economy of nature enter the secondary economy, so that most of them would be paid by manufacturers, with the costs passed on to consumers in the form of higher prices. Now, of course, this would mean that many goods and services would cost considerably more than they do now, since everyone would have the money that now goes to income and sales taxes. This may be a little less of a burden, but it's also relevant that people can avoid resource taxes by changing their buying habits. If you buy a hybrid car, you're going to pay a lot less in petroleum tax and a lot less in tailpipe tax as well. Though the extraction taxes folded into the sticker price for the rare earth materials in the batteries and electronics may set you back a bit, as they should. If you don't own a car at all, you'll laugh all the way to the bank. Similarly, the price of a product made from a metal mined from the earth includes the extraction tax for the ore, but the price of the product made from recycled material doesn't. Recycled material is already in the secondary economy, and thus exempt from extraction taxes. This gives manufacturers a big incentive to use recycled material and undercut the competition. The second set of new taxes targets a different problem. Right now, with the tax laws we have, it's to the economic advantage of businesses to pull their money out of producing goods and services and put it into blowing bubbles in the tertiary economy of paper wealth. That's part of the reason why General Motors manufactured more financial paperwork than cars for quite a few years, until it got into a head-on collision with bubble economics. From a broader perspective, that's part of the reason why America produces so few goods and non-financial services nowadays, and so much in the way of abstract paper wealth. Taxing financial income, but not earned income, does a fair amount to reverse the equation. If putting your money into bonds or derivatives means that any profit you make suffers a large tax bite, while putting your money into producing goods and services means that you pocket the profits tax-free, derivatives and bonds will look much less inviting. Notice also how these two kinds of taxes work to take an even larger bite out of one of the most mistaken economic priorities of our time, the replacement of human labor by machines. Most industrial nations have a serious unemployment problem. Even before the most recent financial crisis, good working-class jobs were very hard to come by. There are plenty of reasons why that happened, but tax policies that make employers pay half again or more of the cost of a worker's wages in order to hire that worker certainly haven't helped. Eliminate those taxes and place taxes on energy and natural raw materials instead, and in a good many cases, a worker instead of a machine becomes the most cost-effective way to do the job. Other arrangements could easily be devised to accomplish the same ends. The point I want to make with this extended example, though, is that some of the ways we do business and pay or don't pay for government services don't fit the realities of an age of ecological limits. A tax code that burdens the secondary economy while encouraging the wasteful plundering of nature and the bubble-blowing antics of the tertiary economy is not going to help us weather the storms of the near future. Any tax code that does the opposite, that makes it more profitable to employ human labor to meet human needs and less profitable to disrupt the natural cycles that undergird our survival or to feed speculative excesses that pump imbalances into an already troubled economy, could be a very helpful asset in a time of crisis and could be put in place tolerably easy without having to tear an entire society to pieces and rebuild it from the ground up. Would such a tax code solve all our problems? Of course not. Still, the attitude that we have to find a single solution that deals with all our problems is a large reason why constructive responses to those problems seem so far out of reach. If we're to face the difficult future ahead of us with any sort of grace, that achievement is much more likely to happen as a result of careful, tentative steps than it is to unfold from some grandiose plan to reach a perfect world in a single leap. Monkeying with the tax code so that it rewards the economic behaviors that might help us get through the approaching troubles, rather than rewarding the economic behaviors that will only make things worse, is only one step in the necessary direction. But it's one step further than any industrial nation has yet gone, and thus is arguably worth taking. Housebreaking the corporations. Another set of changes, mutations, to return to the biological metaphor, worth considering here involves changing the way that business corporations relate to the public good. This subject has seen a great deal of discussion in the alternative press over the last few years, much of it focused on the belief that corporations are something close to evil incarnate. The entire topic could use an approach less burdened with mythic archetypes. It is true, of course, especially in America, that corporate misbehavior has become common, and corporations have come to have an inappropriate degree of influence on the political process. But this latter could be said with equal truth of nearly every other large and well-funded institution in contemporary life, from the retiree lobby to the American Medical Association. The source of the political power of corporations and that of other influential groups deserves to be studied carefully. Despite the rhetoric of impending tyranny retailed equally by the far left and the far right these days, political power in most of today's industrial nations is not particularly centralized. Rather, it's highly diffused, distributed among the quarrelsome factions of a large and fractious political class. No one faction can carry out its agenda without the consent of many others, and the result is that any well-organized faction becomes a power broker. It can drive whatever bargains it wishes in exchange for supporting the agendas of other factions, and use that clout to defend those positions it considers non-negotiable. A good deal of the stalemate that puts necessary reforms out of reach in most of the capitals of the industrial world just now is a function of this process. It's hard to think of any such reform that won't step on the toes of at least one well-funded faction. And so business as usual proceeds on its merry way, even though almost everyone recognizes that the end result will be to nobody's benefit. Consider as one example out of many the way that the retiree lobby keeps the simplest and sanest response to America's looming budget crisis, a means test on Social Security and Medicare, from even coming up for discussion. The same process, enforced by one or another power center within the political class, puts every other effective reform equally out of reach. Corporations are merely one set of power centers making use of this system to pursue their own advantage at the cost of the general welfare. Certain details of the relationship between corporations and society, though, make the conflict between corporate interests and public welfare particularly frequent. Corporations, under the laws of the United States and most other nations, are legal persons. They have many, though not all, of the same rights that natural persons, that is, you and me, have under the law. The most obvious difference these days between corporations' persons and the other power centers that influence our collective decisions is that the corporate kind are noticeably more antisocial. They pursue their purposes, the production of tertiary wealth, with a single-mindedness and a lack of concern for consequences that, in natural persons, would be accurately labeled psychopathic. They've proven themselves consistently willing to lie, cheat, steal, and kill whenever the likely return on those acts outweighs the risk of punishment. E.F. Schumacher, who was amply familiar with these habits of corporate misbehavior, helped to solve them by encouraging different models of corporate governance. One of his central examples was a British firm, Scott Bader and Company Limited, which was organized as a partnership of its own employees. Similar schemes ranging from cooperatives to employee-owned corporations have been put to the test over the years and work at least as well as the usual style of corporate management. Still, no one has yet found a way to convince stockholders and corporate executives to voluntarily accept a reorganization that would sharply decrease their wealth and influence, and until some such means can be found, Schumacher's approach seems unlikely to make a large difference. Some writers in recent years, in response to the parade of corporate abuses, have simply turned up the rhetoric of moral denunciation, with the usual results, a warm glow of self-righteousness on the part of the denouncer, and no effect at all on the denouncee. Others have proposed various means for forcing corporate persons to behave themselves. One popular proposal would subject corporations to regular review by some independent body, which could annul the charter of any corporation that refused to be properly housebroken. What would keep this body honest in the face of the fantastic potential for corruption, the proponent of this notion does not say. But there's another issue here. We've actually got a tolerably effective way of responding to antisocial behavior. We just don't apply it to corporate persons the way we do natural persons. A glance back into the history of law may help clarify the matter. I'm not sure how many people these days know that the law codes of most European nations in the early Middle Ages operated almost entirely on the basis of fines. The principle of wergild, as it was called, gave each person a cash value, If a murder took place, the murderer had to pay the family of the victim that cash value as wergild for the death. Lesser injuries and insults called for lesser fees. It didn't work very well, not least because anyone who had enough money could act the way mainstream economists think we all ought to act, on the basis of a simple cost-benefit analysis. If you could afford to pay the wergild for killing somebody and decided it was worth the expense, why not? So as the Dark Ages gave way to a less chaotic times, legal codes across Europe replaced wergild with punishments that were a good deal less easy to shrug off. This is why natural persons who are convicted of felonies, by and large, can't get away with just paying a fine. They go to jail. Or, if the crime is heinous enough, and it happens in a jurisdiction with capital punishment, they die. While this approach also has its failings, it does seem to deter criminal activity a good deal more effectively than the wergild principle once did. From this perspective, the problem with corporate persons is simple enough. The only risk they run in breaking the law is that they have to pay wergild, and that doesn't constrain antisocial behavior any more effectively now than it did in the Dark Ages. My more perceptive readers may be wondering at this point whether I'm seriously proposing that corporations should be thrown in jail or put to death. This is indeed what I'm proposing, with the adjustments needed to account for the differences between corporate persons and natural persons. The essential nature of imprisonment for a crime, after all, is that the criminal ceases to be a free person. For a specified period of time, he is a chattel of society, and society has the right to profit from his labor during that period. And capital punishment? The criminal, having proven that he isn't willing to abide by even the most minimal standards of social existence, ceases to exist by act of society. Both of these can be applied to corporations easily enough. Imagine, then, that a corporation, we'll call it the Shyster Company, has just been caught deliberately selling worthless securities to widows and orphans. The district attorney files charges of felony fraud and theft in the state court. The trial date arrives, the lawyers bicker, the jury finds the defendant guilty as charged, and the judge sentences the corporation to 10 years in the slammer. In practice, what happens is that the judge appoints a trustee, who takes control of Shyster and all its assets. For the next 10 years, Shyster is a wholly owned subsidiary of the state government. Its stock pays no dividends and has no voting rights. Its directors have to find something else to do with their time. And if the trustee decides that the CEO and other overpaid office fauna have to find new jobs, they have to find new jobs, assuming that they'll not be doing time themselves, as they were very well could be. All profits earned by Shyster during its period of imprisonment go to the state government, subject to set-asides that pay restitution for the victims of the crime. Meanwhile, another conglomerate, we'll call this one Dirty Rotten Scoundrel Incorporated, has been caught knowingly selling food products tainted with deadly bacteria, and a dozen people have died. This time, the district attorney files charges for aggravated first-degree murder. The trial date arrives, the media has a field day, the lawyers bicker, the jury returns a verdict of guilty as charged, the judge sentences DRSI to death, and the appeals court upholds the sentence. In practice, what happens is that on the scheduled day of execution, DRSI ceases to exist. Its stock becomes worthless, its assets are sold off in an auction in which no former shareholder is allowed to bid. Its name and trademarks can never be used again by anybody under penalty of law, and its creditors get whatever scraps are left once the victims' families receive their settlements. It's crucial that the stockholders in both cases, and the creditors in the latter case, suffer for the behavior of the corporation. The stockholders of a corporation are its owners, in fact, and law. They profit from its activities and therefore should pay for its crimes. The laws governing corporations limit the liability of stockholders to the value of their investment, and there's no need to overturn that principle. It simply needs to be applied to criminal cases in the same way that responsibility is applied in cases involving natural persons. Equally, those who loan money to a business already accept the risk that the business may go bankrupt and their money may be lost. Making corporations subject to criminal penalties simply applies the same principle of risk to the possibility that a corporation may violate the law and pay for its crimes. Thus, under this system, if word gets out that a corporation is pushing the limits of legality, the stockholders have a very strong incentive to sell, driving down the value of the stock. Equally, if lenders become aware that a corporation is engaged in really egregious behavior, they have a very strong incentive to charge higher interest rates or even to stop loaning money to the corporation. Neither has any such incentive under the current system, which is one reason why corporations act as though their quarterly profit statements are the only things that matter. To their stockholders and creditors, this is essentially the case. This proposal would change that. Finally, governments have a powerful incentive to enforce the law, which current corporate regulation schemes generally lack. Governments always need money. Raising taxes is unpopular. But catching a crooked corporation that has violated the law and making the rascals pay for their crime makes excellent press, and 5 or 10 years of corporate income in the state treasury would gladden the heart of even the most unregenerate corporate stooge in the state legislature. Readers may be wondering at this point whether I think such a proposal has the chance of a snowball in Beelzebub's backyard of being enacted. As it happens, I do. One of the repeated lessons of history is that the political power of business waxes during times of relative stability and crumbles in times of turmoil and crisis. The long European peace of the 19th century saw business interests dominate most Western governments to an extent that would be considered extreme even by today's lax standards. When that peace shattered in 1914, it took the power of big business with it, and by the time the rubble stopped bouncing in 1954, every Western country had either embraced some degree of socialism outright or adopted radical economic reforms that would have been considered unthinkable before a flurry of bullets at Sarajevo tipped the world into chaos. We are facing a similar age of crisis now, and the wide diffusion of power common in ages of prosperity is usually an early casualty of such times. As current distribution of power breaks down, and today's veto groups find themselves increasingly shut out of the emergency coalitions and charismatic governments that tend to rise in difficult eras, much of what passes for corporate power will inevitably turn out to be much more feeble than it looks today. Several countries, with Russia in the lead, have already seen showdowns between corporate influence and the power of national governments, and the corporations have not fared well in these battles. When the power of money faces off against the power of violence, money comes out a distant second. As the Great Recession deepens, the decline of world petroleum production begins to bite, and rising world powers contend with declining America and each other to settle whose will be the next global empire, the superiority of political and military force to money's influence is likely to play an increasingly large role in determining the balance of power. I suspect by the time the current mess gets much deeper, business interests will be facing organized efforts to do things much more drastic than simply holding corporations responsible for their crimes, and may be willing to bargain in the hope of survival in exactly the same way that their predecessors did in that earlier time of troubles. A crisis of complexity. Another set of ideas commonly suggested in response to the crisis of industrial society are more problematic than the reforms already suggested. These are the programs that seek to deal with the problems of our time by placing a flurry of additional laws and regulations and additional bureaucracies to enforce them on top of the existing laws, regulations, and bureaucracy we have now. Choose a crisis from the puncturing of the housing bubble in 2008 to the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill, and you can count on finding someone, more often quite a few someones, who think the best way to respond is to impose more regulations, hire more bureaucrats, and provide more government grants. On the plane of popular culture, the same habit of thought pervades the often repeated suggestion that the crisis du jour can be solved by a Manhattan Project or Apollo program, government-run and lavishly funded with tax dollars. I am far from certain that this is a good idea. As Joseph Tainter has pointed out in his valuable book, The Collapse of Complex Societies, increases in social complexity are subject to the same law of diminishing returns as anything else, And sooner or later, a society that responds to every challenge by adding a new layer of complexity will reach the point where adding more complexity causes more problems than it solves. Today's industrial societies, pushing the curve of diminishing returns with the help of abundant fossil fuel energy, have become more complex than any other human society in recorded history. Several observations concerning Tainter's insight are thus worth making here. First, the diminishing returns of complexity do not strike everywhere at once, but appear here and there at first, most often in whatever institutions or areas of life have been most heavily loaded with excessive complexity. Thus, a society that has overloaded itself with complexity will tend to heap up more complexity in some areas of life than others, and one or more of these areas will normally tip over into dysfunction sooner than the others. Thus, a society that is hammered by repeated crises of the same kind and tries to solve them with layers of additional complexity that consistently seem to make the problem worse may be at risk of tipping over into a wider dysfunction of which the visible crises are merely symptomatic. Second, if a society has driven itself past the point of negative returns on complexity and continues to try to add complexity to solve the resulting problems, it risks establishing a disastrous feedback loop in which its attempts to solve its problems become the major source of new problems. This can also apply to specifics as well as generalities and show up first in particular aspects of a society's collective life. Third, one of the ironies faced by a society that has reached the point of negative returns on complexity as a means of problem solving is that thereafter, the only way it can solve its problems is by not solving its problems. Any attempt to solve problems by adding additional complexity will simply make matters worse, while allowing some particular problematic heap of complexity to crash and burn may just reduce the complexity of the whole system to a point at which something constructive can actually be done. In the extreme case, where an entire society has pushed itself past the point of negative returns on complexity, political and economic collapse can be an adaptive response to a rising spiral of crisis that can be ended in no other way. Now, the logical solution to a problem caused by too much complexity is to reduce the amount of complexity. Tainter argues that societal collapse has exactly this function. When a society has backed itself into a corner by heaping up more complexity than it can manage, collapse offers the only way out. Still, a proposal to reduce the complexity of contemporary civilization can count on getting no interest from the political classes of today's industrial nations, or for that matter, from the population at large. The experiment has been tried, after all. It's worth remembering the extent to which the baby steps toward lower complexity taken in the 1970s helped fuel the Reagan-Thatcher backlash of the 1980s. The hope of a mass conversion to sustainability by political means, by legislation, let's say, backed up by the massive new bureaucracy that would be needed to enforce green laws affecting every detail of daily life, is yet another attempt to solve a complexity-driven problem by adding on more complexity. That's a popular strategy these days. It makes sense to most of us, since it's the sort of thing that we're used to doing. And it would provide a large number of economic and social niches for specialists, in this case, members of the professional activist community who might reasonably expect to step into staff positions managing the new level of complexity. All of this is very familiar ground, echoing as it does the way that countless other efforts to reform have turned into layers of complexity in the past. To suggest, as I do, that it won't work, doesn't mean that it won't be tried. Quite the contrary. As the industrial age winds down, very nearly every plausible attempt to solve the problems of complexity with more complexity will likely get at least some funding and be given at least a token trial. Much of the same process is already underway in the energy field. We've already had the corn ethanol boom here in the U.S. The cellulose ethanol and algal biodiesel booms have been delayed by the impact of a collapsing economy on credit markets, but somebody will doubtless find a way around that in good time. Down the road a bit, a crash program to build nuclear power plants is pretty much a foregone conclusion. Fusion researchers will have the opportunity to flush billions more dollars down the same rat hole they've been attempting to fill since the 1950s. You name it. If it's complex and expensive, it will get funding. Not all of that money will be entirely wasted either. Current wind power technologies and PV panels may not be sustainable over the long term, but for the decades immediately ahead, they're an excellent investment. Anything that can keep the grid supplied with power as fossil fuel production drops out from under the world's industrial economies may be able to help make the next few decades less brutal than they might otherwise be. With any luck, there'll be a boom in home insulation and weather stripping, a boom in solar hot water heaters, a boom in backyard victory gardens and the like. Small booms, probably, since they aren't complex and expensive enough to catch the contemporary imagination, but even a small boom might help. On the whole, though, the pursuit of complexity as a solution for the problems caused by complexity is a self-defeating strategy. It happens to be the self-defeating strategy to which we're committed, collectively and in most cases individually as well, and it can be dizzyingly hard for many people to think of any action at all that doesn't follow it. Can you think of a way to deal with the problems of complexity in today's industrial nations, problems that include, but are not limited to, rapidly depleting energy supplies, ecological destruction, and accelerating economic turbulence, that doesn't simply add another layer of complexity to the mess? There's at least one such way, pioneered by Schumacher in a different context. It starts with what he termed the principle of subsidiary function. This rule holds that the most effective arrangement to perform any function whatsoever will always assign that function to the smallest and most local unit that can actually perform it. Let me say this again. Schumacher's principle of subsidiary function holds that the most effective arrangement to perform any function whatsoever will always assign that function to the smallest and most local unit that can actually perform it. It's hard to think of any principle that flies more forcefully in the face of every presupposition of the modern world. Economies of scale and centralization of control are so heavily and unthinkingly valued that it rarely occurs to anyone that in many situations they might not actually be economies at all. Still, Schumacher was not a pie-in-the-sky theorist. He drew his conclusions on the basis of most of a lifetime as a working economist in the business world. He noticed that the bigger and more centralized an economic or political system happens to be, the less effectively it could respond to the complex texture of local needs and possibilities that makes up the real world. This rule can be applied to any aspect of the predicament of industrial society you care to name. Attempts to make such a response on the highest and least local level possible, for example, the failed international negotiations to establish a global response to anthropogenic climate change, have done quite a respectable job of offering evidence for Schumacher's contention. Attempts to do the same thing at a national level aren't doing much better. The lower down the ladder you go, and the closer you get to individuals and families confronting the challenges of their own lives, the more success stories you find. By the same logic, the best place to start backing away from an overload of complexity is in the daily life of the individual. What sustains today's social complexity, in the final analysis, is the extent to which individuals turn to complex systems to deal with their needs and wants. To turn away from complex systems on that individual level, in turn, is to undercut the basis for social complexity, and to begin building frameworks for meeting human needs and wants of a much simpler and thus more sustainable kind. It also has the advantage, not a small one, that it's unnecessary to wait for international treaties or government action or anything else to begin having an effect on the situation. It's possible to begin right here, right now, by identifying the complex systems on which you depend for the fulfillment of your needs and wants, and making changes in your own life to shift that dependency onto smaller and more local systems, or onto something yourself, or onto nothing at all. After all, the simplest way to deal with a want or need, when doing so is biologically possible, is to stop needing or wanting it. Such personal responses have traditionally been decried by those who favor grand collective schemes of one kind or another. Still, it deserves to be remembered that a small step that actually happens will do more good than a grandiose plan that never gets off the drawing board, a fate suffered by nearly all of the last half-century's worth of grandiose plans for sustainability, starting from personal choices and local possibilities rather than abstract and global considerations, makes a good deal more likely whatever evolves out of the process might actually work. Tackling the crisis of industrial society from the top down has been tried over and over again by activists for decades now, with no noticeable results. Maybe it's time to try something else. Back to the future. One application of the principle of subsidiary function that has already received serious attention within the peak oil community is the need to relocalize economic activity, that is, to shift from centralized production of goods and services and continental or intercontinental supply and distribution chains to regional or local production of goods and services using locally available resources. Relocalization is a standard event in ages of contraction. When complex societies overshoot their resource bases and decline, centralized economic arrangements fall apart. Long-distance trade declines sharply, and the vast majority of what we now call consumer goods get made at home or very close to home. That violates much of the conventional wisdom that governs economic decisions these days. Centralized economic arrangements are thought to yield economies of scale that make them more profitable than decentralized local arrangements. When history conflicts with theory, though, it's not history that's wrong. So a second look at the conventional wisdom is in order. The economies of scale and the resulting profitability of centralized economic arrangements don't happen by themselves. They depend, among other things, on transportation infrastructure. This doesn't happen by itself either. It happens because governments pay for it for purposes of their own. The Roman roads that made the tightly integrated Roman economy possible, for example, and the interstate highway system that does the same thing for America, were not produced by entrepreneurs. They were created by central governments for military purposes. The legislation that launched the interstate system in the U.S., for example, was pushed by the Department of Defense, which wrestled with transportation bottlenecks all through the Second World War. Government programs of this kind subsidize economic centralization. The same thing is true of other requirements for centralization, for example, the maintenance of public order, so that shipments of consumer goods can get from one side of the country to the other without being looted. Governments don't establish police forces and defend their borders for the purpose of allowing businesses to ship goods safely over long distances, but businesses profit mightily from these indirect subsidies nonetheless. When civilizations come unglued, in turn, all these indirect subsidies for economic centralization go away. Roads are no longer maintained, harbors silt up, bandits infest the countryside, migrant nations invade and carve out chunks of territory for their own, and so on. Centralization stops being profitable because the indirect subsidies that make it profitable aren't there anymore. The decline and fall of the Roman Empire, a well-documented example, was a process of radical relocalization, and the result was the Middle Ages. The Roman Empire handled defense by putting huge linear fortifications along its frontiers. The Middle Ages replaced this with fortifications around every town and baronial hall. The Roman Empire was a political unity where decisions affecting every person within its borders were made by bureaucrats in Rome. Medieval Europe was the antithesis of this, a patchwork of independent feudal kingdoms the size of a Roman province, which were internally divided into self-governing fiefs, those into smaller fiefs, and so on, to the point that a village with a fortified manor house at its center could be an autonomous political unit with its own laws and the right to wage war on its neighbors. The same process of radical decentralization affected the economy as well. The Roman economy was just as centralized as the Roman polity. In major industries such as pottery, mass production at huge regional factories was the order of the day, and the products were shipped out via sea and land for anything up to 1,000 miles to the end user. That came to a halt when roads weren't repaired anymore, the Mediterranean became pirate haven, and too many of the end users were getting dispossessed and dismembered by invading Visigoths. the economic system that evolved to fill the void left by Rome's implosion, was thus every bit as relocalized as a feudal barony, and for exactly the same reasons. That system was based on craft guilds, which worked in a distinctive and, to modern minds, highly counterintuitive way. Each city, and city in this context means anything down to a town of a few thousand people, was an independent economic center providing skilled trades to a fairly small region. The city might have a few industries of more than local fame, but most of its business consisted of manufacturing and selling things to its own citizens and the surrounding countryside. The manufacturing and selling was managed by guilds, which were cooperatives of master craftsmen. To get into a guild-run profession, you had to serve an apprenticeship, usually 7 years, during which you got room and board in exchange for learning the craft and working for your master. You then became a journeyman and worked for a master for wages until you could produce your masterpiece. That's where the word comes from, which was an example of craft work fine enough to convince the other masters to accept you as an equal. Then you became a master with voting rights in the guild. The guild had the responsibility under feudal municipal laws to establish minimum standards for the quality of goods, to regulate working hours and conditions, and to control prices. Economic theories of the time held that there was a just price for any good or service, usually the price that had been customary in the region since time out of mind, and municipal authorities could be counted on to crack down on attempts to charge more than the just price. Most forms of competition were off-limits. If you made your apprentices and journeymen work evenings and weekends to outproduce your competitors, for example, or sold goods below the just price, you'd get in trouble with the guild and could be barred from doing business in the town. The only form of competition that was encouraged was to make and sell a superior product. This was the secret weapon of the guild economy, and it helped drive an age of technical innovation. As Jean Gimpel showed in The Medieval Machine, the stereotype of the Middle Ages as a period of technological stagnation is utterly off the mark. Medieval craftsmen invented the clock, the cannon, and the movable type printing press, perfected the magnetic compass and the water wheel, and made massive improvements in everything from shipbuilding and steelmaking to architecture and windmills, among many other things. The competition between masters and guilds for market share when quality and innovation were the only fields of combat wasn't the only force behind these transformations, to be sure. The medieval monastic system, which put a good fraction of intellectuals of both genders in sheltered workshops where they could use their leisure for any purpose that could be chalked up to the greater glory of God, was also a potent factor, but it certainly played a massive role. Advocates of relocalization in the age of peak oil may thus find it useful to keep the medieval example in mind while planning for the economies of the future. Relocalized communities must be economically viable or they will soon cease to exist. And while viable local communities will be possible in the future, just as they were in the Middle Ages, the steps that will be necessary to make them viable may require some serious rethinking of the habits that now shape our economic lives. A future of victory gardens. Plenty of people have argued that the only valid response to the rising spiral of crisis faced by industrial civilization is to build a completely new civilization from the ground up on more idealistic lines. Even if that latter phrase wasn't a guarantee of disaster, if there's one lesson history teaches, it's that human societies are organic growths, and trying to invent one to fit some abstract idea of goodness is as foredoomed as trying to make an ecosystem do what human beings want. We no longer have time for grand schemes of that sort. To shift metaphors, when your ship has already hit the iceberg and the water's coming in, it's a bit late to suggest rebuilding it from the keel up according to some new scheme of naval engineering. An even larger number of people have argued with equal zeal that the only valid response to the predicament of our time is to save the existing order of things, with whatever modest improvements the person in question happens to fancy, because the alternative is too horrible to contemplate. They may be right, too, if saving the existing order of things was possible, but at this point it's not. A global civilization that is utterly dependent for its survival on ever-expanding supplies of cheap, abundant energy and a stable planetary biosphere is not going to make it in a world of ever-contracting supplies of scarce and expensive energy and a planetary biosphere that the civilization's own activities are pushing into radical instability. Again, when your ship has already hit the iceberg and the water's coming in, it's not helpful to insist that the only option is to keep streaming toward a distant port. What that leaves, to borrow a useful term from one of the most insightful books of the last round of energy crises, is muddling through. Until recently, at least, Warren Johnson's muddling toward frugality seemed to have dropped into the limbo our cultural memory reserves for failed prophecies. Neither he nor, to be fair to him, anybody else in the sustainability movement of the 70s had any idea that the collective response of most industrial nations to the approach of the limits to growth would turn out to be a 30-year vacation from sanity, in which short-term political gimmicks and wildly extravagant drawdown of irreplaceable resources would be widely mistaken for permanent solutions. That put paid to Johnson's hope that simple day-by-day adjustments to dwindling energy and resource supplies would cushion the transition from an economy of abundance to one of frugality. His strategy, though, still has one thing going for it that no other available approach can match. It can still be applied this late in the game. If it's done with enough enthusiasm or desperation, and with a clear sense of the nature of our predicament, it could still get a fair number of us through the mess ahead. And it certainly offers better odds than sitting on our hands and waiting for the ship to sink, which under one pretense or another, is the only other option open to us right now. A strategy of muddling doesn't lend itself to nice, neat checklists of what to do and what to try, so I won't presume to offer a step-by-step plan. Still, showing one way to muddle or to begin muddling and outlining some of the implications of that choice can bridge the gap between abstraction and action and suggest ways that those who are about to muddle might approach the task. And of course, there's always a chance that the example might be applicable to some of the people who read it. With this in mind, I want to talk about victory gardens. As the rising spiral of economic troubles continues, we can expect drastic volatility in the value and availability of money. And here again, remember that the word money refers to any form of wealth that only has value because it can be exchanged for something else. Any economic activity that is solely a means of bringing in money will be held in hostage to the vagaries of the tertiary economy, whether those express themselves through inflation, credit collapse, or what have you. Any economic activity that produces goods and services directly for the use of the producer and his or her family and community will be much less drastically affected by those vagaries. If you depend on your salary to buy vegetables, for example, how much you can eat depends on the value of money at any given moment. If you grow your own vegetables, using your own kitchen and garden scraps to fertilize the soil and saving your own seed, you have a much more direct control over your vegetable supply. The victory garden as a social response to crisis was an invention of the 20th century. Much before then, it would have been a waste of time to encourage civilians in time of war to dig up their backyards and put in vegetable gardens because nearly everybody who had a backyard had a garden already in it. That was originally why houses had backyards, the household economy, which produced much of the goods and services used by people in pre-petroleum Europe and America, didn't stop at the four walls of a house. Garden beds, cold frames, and hen houses in urban backyards kept pantries full, while no self-respecting farm wife would have done without the garden out back and a dozen or so fruit trees close by the farmhouse. Those useful habits only went into decline when rail transportation and the commercialization of urban food supplies gave birth to the modern city in the course of the 19th century. When 1914 came around and Europe blundered into the carnage of the First World War, the entire system had to be reinvented from scratch in many urban areas, since the transport networks that brought fresh food to the cities in peacetime had other things to do, and importing food from overseas became problematic for all combatants in a time of naval blockades and unrestricted submarine warfare. The lessons learned from that experience became a standard part of military planning thereafter. And when the Second World War came, well-organized Victory Garden programs shifted into high gear, helping to take the hard edges off food rationing. It's a measure of their success that despite the massive mismatch between Britain's wartime population and its capacity to grow food, and the equally massive challenge of getting food imports through a gauntlet of U-boats, food shortages in Britain never reached the level of actual famine. In the 70s, in turn, the same thing happened on a smaller scale without government action. All over the industrial world, people who were worried about the future started digging victory gardens in their backyards, and books offering advice on backyard gardening became steady sellers. Some of those are still in print today. These days, sales figures in the home garden industry reliably jolt upwards whenever the economy turns south or something else sends fears about the future upwards. For many people, planting a victory garden has become a nearly instinctive response to troubled times. It's fashionable in some circles to dismiss this sort of thing as an irrelevance, but such analyses miss the point of the phenomena. The reason that the victory garden has become a fixture for our collective response to trouble is that it engages one of the core features of the predicament individuals and families face in the twilight of the industrial age, the disconnection between the tertiary economy on the one hand and the primary and secondary economies on the other. The value you get from a backyard garden differs from the value you get from your job or your savings in a crucial way. Money doesn't mediate between your labor and the results. If you save your own seeds, use your own muscles, and fertilize the soil with compost you make from kitchen and garden waste, and many gardeners do these things as a matter of course, the only money your gardening requires of you is whatever you spend on beer after a hard day's work. The vegetables that help feed your family are produced by the primary economy of soil and sun, and the secondary economy of sweat. The tertiary economy has been cut out of the loop. Now, it will doubtless be objected that nobody can grow all the food for a family in an ordinary backyard, so the rest of their food remains hostage to the tertiary economy. This is more or less true, but it's less important than it looks. Even in a really thumping depression, very few people have no access to money at all. The problem is much more one of not having enough money to get everything you need by way of the tertiary economy. An effective response usually involves placing any economic activity that can be done without the involvement of money outside the reach of the tertiary economy, and prioritizing whatever money can be had for those uses that require it. You're not likely to be able to grow field crops in your backyard, for example, but grains, dried beans, and the like can be bought in bulk very cheaply at present, and will almost certainly be available in bulk across North America even in times of turmoil. What can't be bought cheaply now, and in a time of financial chaos may not be for sale at all, are exactly the things you can most effectively grow in a backyard garden: the vegetables, vine and shrub fruits, eggs, chicken and rabbit meat, and other foods that provide the vitamins, minerals, and nutrients you can't get from 50-pound sacks of rice and beans. These are the sorts of things people a century and a half ago produced in their kitchen gardens, along with medicinal herbs to treat illnesses and maybe a few dye plants for homespun fabric. These are the sorts of things that make sense to grow at home in a world where the economy won't support the kind of abundance most people in the industrial world take for granted today. It will also doubtless be objected that even if you reduce the amount of money you need for food, you still need money for other things, and so a victory garden isn't the answer. This is true enough if your definition of an answer requires that it simultaneously solve every aspect of the predicament of modern industrial society. Waiting for the one perfect answer to come around is a refined version of doing nothing while the water rises. Muddling requires making many small adjustments rather than one grand plan. Planting a victory garden in the backyard is one adjustment to the impact of a dysfunctional money economy on the far from minor issue of getting food on the table. Other impacts will require other adjustments. A third objection is that not everybody can plant a victory garden in the backyard. This is true enough. A good many people don't have backyards these days, and some of those who do are forbidden by restrictive covenants from using their yards as anything but props for their home's largely imaginary resale value. Still, a victory garden is simply an example of the way that people have muddled through hard times in the past, and might well muddle through the impending round of hard times in the future. If you can't grow a garden in your backyard, see if there's a neighbor or a neighborhood allotment program that will let you garden somewhere else. Or look for something else that will let you meet some of your needs with your own labor without letting money get in the way. That latter, of course, is the central point of this example. At a time when the tertiary economy is undergoing the first stages of an uncontrolled and challenging simplification, if you can disconnect something you need from that economy, you've insulated a part of your life from at least some of the impacts of the chaotic resolution of the mismatch between limitless paper wealth and the limited real wealth available to our species on this very finite planet. Now, of course, it's true that the cost of equipping somebody to perform some economic function locally has already entered the rising collective conversation around peak oil in an informal way. What Transition Towns proponent Rob Hopkins calls the Great Reskilling, the process by which individuals who have no productive skills outside a centralized industrial economy learn how to make and do things on their own, has had to take place within a tolerably strict constraints of what individuals can afford to buy in the way of tools and workspaces, since there isn't exactly a torrent of grant money available for people who want to become blacksmiths, brewers, boat builders, or practitioners of other useful crafts. It may be worth suggesting, though, that Schumacher's theory of intermediate technology might be worth applying directly by those individuals and communities who are willing to put that project into practice. The less it costs in terms of energy and other resources to prepare a community to deal with one or more of its economic needs, after all, the more will be available for other projects. Equally, the more good ideas that can be garnered from the dusty pages of publications issued by Schumacher's Intermediate Technology Development Group and its many equivalents, and put to work during the industrial world's decline to third world status, the more creativity can be spared for other challenges. After retirement. The transformations that will force the expansion of Victory Gardens also promises, as Chapter 3 suggested, to bring an end to one of the most basic expectations of people in today's industrial world. Retirement as a social habit was entirely the product of the zenith of the Age of Abundance. For a brief window of time, rather less than a century, it made financial and political sense for nations in the developed world to pay their elderly citizens to stay out of the workforce in order to keep unemployment down to politically bearable levels. All this unfolded in turn from an industrial economy so lavishly supplied with cheap energy that human labor was worth replacing with machines wherever the technology permitted, and so greedy for new markets that every part of human life was made subject to market forces. Before that period began, something less than half of all economic activity, even in the industrial world, had anything to do with the market at all. Most women and many men outside the age of regular employment worked in the household economy, governed by custom and interfamily exchange rather than market forces. This included essentially everyone who would be eligible for retirement by the standards of the age that has just ended. Outside the market, but not outside the demand for skilled labor, elderly people typically provided household goods and services to a household somewhere in their extended family. This was their full-time job. By contributing the value of their labor and skills, they earned their keep. The end of the age of cheap energy means that such household economies will be viable again. It also means that they will again be necessary. When the limited energy and resources of a contracting society have to be prioritized for urgent needs, takeout meals and convenience foods will sooner or later draw the short straw. In their absence, most food will once again be made at home from raw ingredients. When the energy cost of a global network of sweatshops that keeps Americans clothed can no longer be met, clothing will once again be made at home from raw fiber, as it was not long ago, and so on. All this requires human labor. Thus, a society no longer supplied with nearly unlimited amounts of cheap, abundant energy, will have every incentive to keep elderly people in the household labor force, and neither the incentive nor the resources to keep them in comfortable idleness. Now, of course, it's true that we will not be landing in such a society overnight. It's also true that the clout of the retiree lobby in most industrial nations is such that public and private pensions will be looted or simply dissolve in a general financial collapse only when every other option has been exhausted. Though in the United States, at least, the vast tide of red ink currently flooding out of Washington, D.C. is likely to bring about this eventuality sooner rather than later. Still, it's quite possible that at least some of today's retirees and soon-to-be retirees will manage to cling to that status, at least for a while. If I were asked for advice about retirement then, it would probably go something like this. If you're already retired or within a few years of retirement, it's probably worthwhile to put any investment money you have into a stable investment, if you can find one. Still, it's unwise to assume that your investments will be worth anything in the long run, and having a plan B would be a very good idea. If you're more than a decade or so out from retirement, having a plan B in place is essential. If you're 30 years out or more, as I am, forget about plan A for now. You can look into the options for investment later, once the wreckage of the last few decades has been hauled away and a new economic order has begun to take shape. But you probably will never retire. What sort of plan B might work best depends on so many local and personal variables that specifics would be misleading. If you've got a large family with whom you're on good terms, bone up on your home and economic skills. 10 years from now, when four of your grandkids, their spouses, and their children live in one rundown McMansion, having Grandma and Grandpa there to cook meals, tend children, and tend the garden will likely be worth much more than your keep. If you don't have a family or you can't stand them, cultivate friendships with younger friends, or get ready to take up a second career that you can continue into advanced old age. No matter what you choose, it's not going to be as much fun as sitting on a lawn chair in a sunbelt trailer park, but then the future is under no obligation to limit itself to those options we prefer. More generally, the world of money will become much less relevant to most people in the years to come. Few of us will have the option of separating themselves completely from the money economy for many years to come. As long as today's governments continue to function, for example, they will demand money for taxes, and money will continue to be the gateway resource for many goods and services, including some that will be very difficult to do without. Still, there is no reason why distancing oneself from the tertiary economy has to be an all-or-nothing thing. Any step toward the direct production of goods and services for one's own use, with one's own labor, using resources under one's own direct control, is a step toward the world that will emerge after your money. It's also a safety cushion against the disintegration of the tertiary economy going on around us. Afterword. Small is beautiful. It has been nearly four decades now since the limits to industrial civilization's trajectory of limitless material growth on a limited planet have been clearly visible on the horizon of our future. Over that time, a remarkable paradox has unfolded. The closer we get to the limits to growth, the more clearly those limits impact our lives, and the more obviously our current trajectory points toward a brick wall of a difficult future, the less most people in the industrial world seem to be able to imagine any alternative to driving the existing order of things until the wheels fall off. This is as true in many corners of the activist community as it is in the most unregenerate of corporate boardrooms. For most of today's environmentalists, for example, renewable energy isn't something that people ought to produce for themselves, unless they happen to be wealthy enough to afford the rooftop PV systems that have become the latest status symbol in suburban neighborhoods on either coast of the U.S. It's something that utilities and governments are supposed to bring online as fast as possible, using existing power grids and habits of energy use, so that people in the industrial world can keep on using as much electricity as they want. This approach is far from the only option available. In the energy crisis of the 70s, simple conservation and efficiency measures sent the world petroleum consumption down by 15% in a single decade and caused comparable drops in other forms of energy consumption across the industrial world. Most of these measures went out the window in the final binge of the age of cheap oil that followed, so there's plenty of low-hanging fruit to pluck. That same era saw a great many thoughtful people envision ways that we could lead relatively comfortable and humane lives while consuming a great deal less energy and the products of energy than people in the industrial world do today. It can be a troubling experience to turn the pages of Rain Book or the Book of the New Alchemists, to name only two of the better products of that mostly forgotten era, and compare the sweeping view of future possibilities that undergirded their approach to a future of energy and material shortages with the cramped imaginations of the present. It's even more troubling to notice that you can pick up yellowing copies of most of these books for a couple of dollars each in the used book trade, at a time when their practical advice is more relevant than ever, and their prophecies of what would happen if the road to sustainability was not taken are looking more prescient by the day. Thus, our collective refusal to follow the lead of those who urged us to learn how to get by with less has not spared us the necessity of doing exactly that. That's the problem, ultimately, with driving headlong at a brick wall. You can stop by standing on the brake pedal, or you can stop by hitting the wall, but either way, you're going to stop. The brick wall ahead of us at this point in history marks, among other things, the conclusion of a long historical trajectory. From the early days of the Industrial Revolution into the early 1970s, the United States possessed the immense economic advantage of sizable reserves of whatever the cutting-edge energy source happened to be. During what Lewis Mumford called the ecotechnic era, when water wheels were the prime mover for industry and canals were the core transportation technology, the United States prospered because it had an abundance of mill sites and internal waterways. During Mumford's paleotechnic era, when coal and railways replaced water and canal boats, the United States once again found itself blessed with huge coal reserves. And with the arrival of the neotechnic era, when petroleum and highways became the new foundation of power, the United States found that nature had supplied it with so much oil that in 1950 it produced more petroleum than all the other countries combined. That trajectory came to an abrupt end in the 1970s, when nuclear power, expected by nearly everyone to be the next step in the sequence, turned out to be hopelessly uneconomical, and renewables proved unable to take up the slack at a cost the American political class was willing to pay. The neotechnic age, in effect, turned out to have no successor. Since then, the United States has been trying to stave off the inevitable sharp downward readjustment of our national standard of living and international importance following the depletion of the natural resources that once undergirded American economic and political power. In the effort to prevent that readjustment from happening, the U.S. tried accelerating drawdown of natural resources, abandoning our national infrastructure, our industries, and our agricultural hinterlands, and building ever more baroque systems of financial gimmickry to prop up our decaying economy with wealth from overseas. Over the last decade and a half, the government has resorted to systematically inflating speculative bubbles, and now, with its back to the wall, the U.S. is printing money, under the euphemism of quantitative easing, as though there's no tomorrow. It's possible that the current U.S. administration will be able to pull one more rabbit out of its hat and find a new gimmick to keep things going for a while longer. I have to confess that this does not look likely to me. Monetizing debt, as economists call the attempt to pay a nation's bills by means of the printing press, is a desperation move. It's hard to imagine any reason that would have been chosen if there had been any other option in sight. What this means is that we may just have moved into the end game of America's losing battle with the consequences of its own history. For many years now, people in the community of those concerned about the future have had, or thought they had, the luxury of ample time to make plans and take action. Every so often, books would be written and speeches made claiming that something had had to be done right away while there was still time. But most people took that as the rhetorical flourish it usually was, and went on with their lives in the confident expectation that the crisis was still a long ways off. We may no longer have that option. If I read the signs correctly, America has finally reached the point where its economy is so far into ecological imbalance that disintegration is beginning in earnest. If so, a great many of the things most of us in this country have treated as permanent fixtures are likely to go away over the years immediately before us, as the United States transforms itself into a third world country. The changes involved won't be sudden, and it seems unlikely that most of them will get much play in the domestic mass media. A decade from now, let's say, when half the American workforce has no steady work, decaying suburbs have mutated into squalid shantytowns, and domestic insurgencies flare across the South and the Mountain West, those who still have access to cable television will no doubt be able to watch talking heads explain how we're better off than we were in 2000. The economic debacle we are experiencing didn't just happen by chance. It became inevitable once the political classes of the industrial world convinced themselves that money was the source of wealth, rather than the mere measure of wealth it actually is. Decades of bad policy that encouraged making money at the expense of the production of real wealth followed from those ideas. The result was the transformation of a vast amount of paper, quote-unquote, wealth, that is, money of one kind or another, into some malign equivalent of the twinkle dust of a child's fairy tale. One way to make sense of the resulting collision between the brittle front end of industrial civilization and the hard surface of nature's brick wall is to compare the spring of 2010 with the autumn of 2007. Those two seasons had an interesting detail in common. In both cases, the price of oil passed $80 a barrel after a prolonged period of price increases. And in both cases, this was followed by a massive debt crisis. In 2007, largely driven by speculation in the futures market, the price of oil kept on zooming upwards, peaking just south of $150 a barrel before crashing back to earth. So far, at least, there's no sign of a spike of that sort happening this time, although this is mostly because speculators are focused on other assets these days. In 2007, though, the debt crisis also resulted in a dramatic economic downturn. And as I write these words, the world's chances of dodging a repeat of the same experience do not look good. Here in the U.S., most measures of general economic activity are faltering where they aren't plunging. The sole exceptions are those temporarily propped up by an unparalleled explosion of government debt. And unemployment has become so deeply entrenched that what we do about the very large number of Americans who have exhausted the 99 weeks of unemployment benefits that current law allows them in most states is becoming a significant political issue. Even the illegal economy is taking a massive hit. A recent news story broadcast on National Public Radio noted that the price of marijuana has dropped so sharply that Northern California, where it's a major cash crop, is seeing panic selling and sharp economic contractions. What's going on here is precisely what the Limits to Growth warned us about in 1973. The costs of continued growth have risen faster than growth itself and are reaching a level that is forcing the economy to its knees. By costs, of course, the authors of the Limits to Growth weren't talking about money. The costs that matter are energy, resources, and labor. It takes a great deal more of all of those to extract oil from deep water wells in the Gulf of Mexico or oil sands in Alberta, say, than it used to take to get sweet light crude from the shallow strata in Pennsylvania or Texas. And since offshore drilling and oil sands make up an increasingly large share of what we've got left, those wells in Pennsylvania and Texas have been pumped dry, or nearly so. These real, non-monetary costs have climbed steadily. The price of oil in dollars functions here as a workable proxy. In the language of the tertiary economy, for the real cost of oil production in energy, resources, and labor, the hard currency of the primary and secondary economies. The evidence of the last few years suggests that when the price of oil passes $80 a barrel, that's a sign that the primary and secondary costs of energy have risen high enough that the rest of the economy begins to crack under the strain. Since astronomical levels of debt have become a standard practice all through today's global economy, the ability of marginal borrowers to service their debt is where the cracks show up first. In the fall of 2007, many of those marginal borrowers were homeowners in the U.S. and U.K. In the spring of 2010, they included entire nations. Thus, it's past time to realize that the age of abundance is over. The period from 1945 to 2005, when almost unimaginable amounts of cheap petroleum sloshed throughout the economies of the world's industrial nations and transformed life in those nations almost beyond recognition, still shapes most of our thinking and nearly all of our expectations. Not one significant policymaker or mass media pundit in the industrial world has begun to talk about the impact of the end of the age of abundance. It's an open question if any of them have grasped how fundamental the changes will be as the new age of post-abundance economics begins to bear down. Most ordinary people in the industrial world, for their part, are sleepwalking through one of history's great transitions. The issues that concern them are still defined entirely by the calculus of abundance. Most Americans these days, for example, worry about managing a comfortable retirement, paying for increasingly expensive medical care, and providing their children with a college education and whatever amenities they consider important. It has not yet entered their darkest dreams. They need to worry about access to such basic necessities as food, clothing, and shelter. The fate of local economies and communities shredded by decades of malign neglect, and the rise of serious threats to the survival of constitutional government and the rule of law. Even among those who warn that today's Great Recession could bottom out at a level even worse than that reached in the Great Depression, very few have grappled with the consequences of a near-term future in which millions of Americans live in shantytowns and struggle to find enough to eat every single day. To paraphrase Sinclair Lewis, that did happen here only 80 years ago, and it did so at a time when the United States was a net exporter of industrial products and the world's largest producer and exporter of petroleum to boot. The same scale of economic decline in a nation that exports very little besides unpayable IOUs and is the world's largest consumer and importer of petroleum could easily have results much closer to that of the early 20th century in Central Europe. To suggest only one example, near universal impoverishment, food shortages, epidemics, civil wars, and outbreaks of vicious ethnic cleansing, bracketed by two massive wars that each had body counts in the tens of millions. It needs to be remembered, however, that this did not equate to the total collapse into a Cormac McCarthy future that so many people fantasize about these days. I've spent years wondering why it is that so many people seem unable to conceive of any future other than business as usual on the one hand and apocalyptic extremism on the other. Whatever the motives that drive this curious fixation, though, it results in a nearly complete blindness to the real risks the future is more likely to hold for us. It makes a useful exercise to take current survivalist notions about preparing for the future and ask yourself, how many of them would have turned out to be useful over the decade or two ahead if someone had pursued exactly those strategies in Poland or Slovakia, let's say, in the years right before 1914? Measure the difference between the real and terrible events of that period on the one hand and the fantasies of infinite progress or apocalyptic collapse that so often pass for realistic images of our future on the other, and you have some sense of the gap that has to be crossed in order to make sense of a world after abundance. One way or another, we will cross that gap. The question is how many of us will make the crossing in advance and have time to take constructive actions in response, and how many will do so only in retrospect, thinking ruefully of the dollar and hours spent preparing for an imaginary future while the real one was breathing down their necks. I've talked at quite some length in this and other books, about the kind of preparations that will likely help individuals, families, and communities deal with the future of resource shortages, economic implosion, political breakdown, and potential civil war, that the missed opportunities and purblind decisions of the last 30 years have made agonizingly likely here in the United States, and, with an infinity of local variations, elsewhere in the industrial world. Those points remain crucial. It still makes a great deal of sense to start growing some of your own food, to radically downsize your dependence on complex technological systems, to reduce your energy consumption as far as possible, to free up at least one family member from the money economy for full-time work in the domestic economy, and so on. Still, there's another dimension to all this, and it has to be mentioned, though it's certain to raise hackles. For the last three centuries, and especially for the last half century or so, it's become increasingly common to define a good life as one provided with the largest possible selection of material goods and services. That definition has become so thoroughly hardwired into our modern ways of thinking that it can be very hard to see past it. Of course, there are certain very basic material needs without which a good life is impossible. But those are a good deal fewer and simpler than contemporary attitudes assume. And once those are provided, material abundance becomes a much more ambivalent blessing than we'd like to think. In a very real sense, this way of thinking mirrors the old joke about the small boy with a hammer who thinks everything is a nail. In an age of unparalleled material abundance, the easy solution for any problem or predicament was to throw material wealth at it. That did solve some problems, but it arguably worsened others, and left the basic predicaments of human existence untouched. Did it really benefit anyone to spend trillions of dollars and the talents of some of our civilization's brightest minds creating high-end medical treatments to keep the very sick alive and miserable for a few extra months of life, for example, so that we could pretend to ourselves that we had evaded the basic human predicament of the inevitability of death? Whatever the answer, the end of the age of abundance draws a line under that experiment. Within not too many years, it's safe to predict, only the relatively rich will have the dubious privilege of spending the last months of their lives hooked up to complicated life support equipment. The rest of us will end our lives the way our great-grandparents did, at home, more often than not, with family members and maybe a nurse to provide palliative care, while our bodies do what they were born to do. And shut down. Within not too many years, more broadly, only a very few people anywhere in the world will have the option of trying to escape the core uncertainties and challenges of human existence by chasing round after round of consumer goods. The rest of us will count ourselves lucky to have the basic material needs squarely provided for, and will have to deal once again with fundamental questions of meaning and value. It probably will come as no surprise that here again, E.F. Schumacher was well ahead of the rest of us. His final, posthumously published book, A Guide for the Perplexed, left behind the economic topics that occupied most of his public career to ask hard questions and propose provocative answers concerning the most basic issues surrounding human life. It would take another book, the size of this one, if not larger, to offer any meaningful comment on the points Schumacher raised in this slender volume. But one theme that runs throughout it is a recognition that material wealth, however defined, only satisfies a certain sharply limited number of human needs. And a life oriented entirely toward material accumulation has failed to deal with most of the possibilities open to human existence. In the recognition of that failure, other possibilities open up. Still, the habits of thought instilled in us by an age of abundance get in the way of recognizing most of those possibilities. It's worth noting that while there's plenty of talk about the monasteries of the Dark Ages among people who are aware of the impending decline and fall of our own civilization, next to none of it has discussed, much less dealt with, the secret behind the success of monasticism, the deliberate acceptance of extreme material poverty. Quite the contrary. All the plans for lifeboat eco-villages I've encountered, so far at least, aim at preserving some semblance of a middle-class lifestyle into the indefinite future. That choice puts these projects in the same category as the lavish villas in which the wealthy inhabitants of Roman Britain hoped to ride out their own trajectory of decline and fall, a category most notable for its long history of total failure. The European Christian monasteries that preserved Roman culture through the Dark Ages did not offer anyone a middle-class lifestyle by the standards of their own time, much less those of ours. Neither did the Buddhist monasteries that preserved Heian culture through the Shenkō-jidai, Japan's bitter age of wars, or the Buddhist and Taoist monasteries that preserved classical Chinese culture through a good half-dozen cycles of collapse, or any of the other examples of successful monasticism in history. Monasteries in all these cases were places people went to be very, very poor. That was the secret of their achievements, because when you reduce your material needs to the absolute minimum, the energy you don't spend maintaining your standard of living can be put to work doing something more useful. Now, it's probably too much to hope for that some similar movement might spring into being here and now. We're a couple of centuries too soon for that. The great age of Christian monasticism in the West didn't begin until the 6th century CE, by which time the Roman economy of abundance had been long gone for so long that nobody even pretended that material wealth was an answer to the human condition. Still, the monastic revolution kick-started by Benedict of Nursia drew on a long history of Christian monastic ventures. Those unfolded in turn from the first tentative communal hermitages of early Christian Egypt. And all these projects, though this is not often mentioned, took part of their inspiration and a good deal of their ethos from the Stoics of pagan Greece and Rome. Movements away from an obsession with material wealth are in fact very common in civilizations that have passed the Hubbard's Peak of their own core resource base. There's good reason for that. In a contracting economy, it becomes easier to notice that the less you need, the less vulnerable you are to the ups and downs of fortune, and the more you can get done of whatever it is that you happen to want to do. That's an uncongenial lesson at the best of times, and during times of material abundance, you won't find many people learning it. It's one of the marks of Schumacher's insights that he did learn it, and tried in various ways to communicate it to a mostly uninterested world. Still, in the world after abundance, it's hard to think of a lesson that deserves more careful attention.